Hello, this is the Fakeologist speaking. You're listening to Master Fake Theater, where I present to you some of my favorite 9/11-centric audios. I selected these audios based on the idea that they will help further your knowledge of the hoax that 9/11 was. While I can't endorse every thought in each audio, I do think they're worth your while. Please visit Fakeologist.com to explore endless hours of 9/11 and media fakery research. Thank you for listening, and on with the Master Fake Broadcast.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, you're listening to the Hour of the Time. Tonight, we're going to do something that we've been telling you we were going to do for quite a while. And without any further introduction, let's get into it. That's right, folks. It's the return of our medical sleuth, CAGI member Alex Loglia, who many, many months ago promised to return with his treatise on germs. And tonight, here it is. Now, because we don't have any medical experts here or laboratories with which to conduct these simple experiments, I'm going to have to advise you not to believe what you hear tonight, or from any other source for that matter, at any time. Listen to everyone, read everything, believe nothing unless you can prove it in your own research. We believe that there may be some validity to the information you're going to hear tonight, and that's why we're presenting it to you. However, whether or not it turns out to be true is going to depend upon whether or not we're able to conduct some experiments to either prove it true or prove it false. According to the premise in the tape you're going to hear tonight, the experiments should be fairly easy to conduct.
Good evening, folks. It's been a while since I was on with the last show on vaccinations, and before I get into tonight's subject, which is going to be about the history of the germ theory, I want to give you a little bit of information that I've had dug up in the interim about vaccinations. Particularly, I'm going to mention a couple of bills they're trying to push through Congress right now that you might want to contact your representatives about. I don't have time to go into detail on the show here as to what they're about, but I strongly suggest you contact your representatives about these particular bills. They are S-732, the Comprehensive Child Immunization Act of 1993, and S-887, the National Immunization Improvement Act of 1993. Both of these bills were incorporated into the Public Service Act of the Senate Budget Bill and passed by the Senate on June 25th, 1993. Also, H.R. 2264, Universal Access to Childhood Immunizations. This act was incorporated into the House Budget Reconciliation Act and passed by the House on May 27, 1993. S-887 and S-733, which is the National Immunization Act of 1993 and the Comprehensive Child Health Immunization Act of 1993, are both still pending before the Senate Committee on Finance, so there is still time to get those particular bills turned back and to have them overthrown, so to speak. They're not good news, ladies and gentlemen, and really, this is a very important issue, so I hope you will take some action. We did have a minor success in that the National Immunization Registry, which was scheduled to open up in 1994, has been shot down, but I'm sure it will raise its ugly head again soon. So keep your eyes out for any information you may hear about a National Immunization Registry. Big Brother wants us to be experimental guinea pigs and wants to track us very carefully in reference to immunizations, and that's what that bill is all about. Now, tonight, I'm going to be talking, as promised, about the germ theory, about a great fraud named Louis Pasteur, who was perhaps the single most malicious influence on the medical profession of the modern era. Before I even do that, though, I do want to make a little comment about the last show on vaccinations also, which I just recalled. I'd like to thank everyone who responded to the show. I heard some very disturbing stories, some very moving personal testimony from a number of people, and I really do appreciate all that. If you have any more of these personal experiences in reference to vaccinations or in reference to anything that I'm going to be talking about over the next couple of nights, please do write me. I will give you an address where you can get in contact with me at the end of the show. I love new information, and I love people's personal experiences, especially about vaccinations, because I am compiling some data right now to make sure that we never have to have compulsory immunizations. But if we don't do some serious work right now, that very well could become a reality. I do have a little correction also from the last show. One of my colleagues pointed out to me that I had mentioned Jonas Salk admitted that two-thirds of the polio cases were actually caused by his vaccine. Well, I did not mention the fact that this period that he himself was referring to was from 1966 to 1976. It was dropped out of my notes, but I just wanted to mention it because I never want to have it said that I willfully misled anyone or did not correct my mistakes. Okay. Tonight, though, I am going to be talking about the germ theory, and I am, again, going to be doing a lot of reading, and I'm doing this because you are going to require a tremendous amount of scientific fact to counteract the brainwashing that you've received on this subject. If you thought the information that I gave you on vaccinations on the last show was disturbing and hard to believe, let me tell you, this show tonight will be a stretch for you as well. We are talking about the germ theory here, the idea that germs cause disease, which is absolutely not true. Now, I don't intend to go into this with the purpose of simply shocking you and making you believe some very interesting new information. The reason I'm going into all the things that I'm going into over the next couple of nights, specifically the germ theory and AIDS, is because hopefully by the end of this series, I will be ready to give you some of the information that I cherish the most in this field, which is how to be healthy. But before I can impart that information to you, I have to counteract all of the poor mental training and go against all the paradigms that you have built up inside of you since you were born regarding how you get sick, regarding what disease is, and regarding how to be healthy. But that is my ultimate goal. I do intend to do a show after all this, finally, to tell you the good stuff, what you can do to make sure that you can live a long and healthy life. Now, we have all been led to believe that there are these nasty little bacteria and viruses out there who are constantly attacking us, and when they're successful in their efforts, we get sick. In short, we've been taught for decades, actually centuries, that germs cause disease. But as usual, when we start to deal with truth and reality, what is really going on is the exact opposite of what we've been taught. Folks, disease causes germs. Germs do not cause disease. My own years of research, study, and experimentation have clearly shown me that diseases of all kinds do not stem from germs or viruses. Disease, as we know it, is the result of toxic inputs into our biological system, things like poisons disguised as medications, vaccinations, chemical poisons in our food, air, water, radiation, x-rays, drug abuse, including smoking and alcohol, stress, and destructive emotional states, and most important, poor nutrition. I'm sure many of you out there may think I'm a little bit off my rocker at this point, but do try to suspend your judgment just for a little while as I get into this presentation. You have to understand that modern medicine studies illness, disease, and death. They study dead bodies, diseased organs, and sick people. Modern medicine does not and has never studied health. You have to get this idea in your mind very clearly from the start. As a result of this attitude, medical treatment today is symptom-driven, meaning that modern medicine tries to mask, lessen, or eliminate the symptoms of disease rather than treat the cause. Folks, our bodies are absolutely amazing, and science knows at this point next to nothing about how our bodies really work in a profound and essential way. Science has a way of naming things and thereby believing it understands. Scientists tend to identify symptoms, create a name, and find a germ, and believe they have understood something. But this way of looking at things is totally artificial and backwards. Now, listen to what I'm going to say very carefully. Disease is the cure, ladies and gentlemen. The disease is the cure. Through toxic drugs, vaccinations, malnutrition, poor eating habits, stress, pesticides, pollution, radiation, and negative emotional states, our bodies are constantly being poisoned, and our bodies are constantly eliminating all sorts of these toxins. It is this natural process of elimination that medicine has labeled disease. From the most mild things like colds all the way up to cancer, what we call germs are organisms and pieces of viral material which are constantly present in our bodies. To claim them as a cause of the symptoms just because of their coincidental presence would indicate very poor reasoning indeed, but this is exactly what has been done. Even more, it is this state of elimination, which we call disease, which medicine calls disease, which creates environments within our bodies where germs can thrive. But these germs do not cause the disease. Germs are the garbage men of our bodies and participate in the elimination and breakdown of toxins and waste products in our bodies. Let me quote Dr. Raymond Reif, who I will mention again later. Suffice it to say that he was a brilliant researcher, and his brilliant discovery of a very unique cure for cancer led to him being victimized by the modern medical establishment, which eventually led to his total breakdown. He developed the most powerful light microscope of his day, with magnifications up to 60,000 diameters and resolutions up to 31,000 diameters. Our current electron microscopes have resolutions up to 25,000 diameters and magnify 100 to 200,000 diameters. But these electron microscopes force the subject being observed to be put into a vacuum, and then it bombards the subject with a storm of electrons. Thus, the structure of what we see in electron micrographs is not real. It has been altered. And we never see electron micrographs of anything in a living state as a result of the entire process that you use to do an electron micrograph. Now, Dr. Reif was around in the early to middle years of the 1900s, and his scopes allowed the observation of living tissues and bacteria. In fact, he had one scope that he developed that rivaled the resolution and magnification of today's current electron microscope. Nevertheless, his words will serve me well here as an introduction tonight. I quote Dr. Raymond Reif. In reality, it is not the bacteria themselves that produce the disease, but we believe it is the chemical constituents of these microorganisms in acting upon the unbalanced cell metabolism of the human body that in actuality produce the disease. We also believe if the metabolism of the human body is perfectly balanced or poised, it is susceptible to no disease. He goes on later, we have in many instances produced all the symptoms of a disease chemically in experimental animals without the inoculation of any virus or bacteria into their tissues. Now, that's a very simple statement, folks, but it's very important, because what Dr. Rice did was he realized, after observing living tissue, living cells, living bacteria and viruses, that germs don't cause disease, and that the symptoms of disease in his experimental animals could be produced with chemical toxins. But these were the exact same symptoms that were being blamed for diseases which the medical establishment claimed were caused by germs. It's important that all of you out there understand that modern medicine and the germ theory is based upon a misguided assumption about infectious diseases originating over a century ago. I'm going to discuss this shortly, but first I'm going to read you a little excerpt from Michael Crichton's recent book/movie, Jurassic Park. I want to use this quote to put you in the right frame of mind, because I'm sure many of you out there, if not already, will very soon be asking yourselves, how could this happen? How could scientists working in this field allow this kind of fraud to occur? And I'm going to answer that question for you folks, because Michael Crichton has done it quite eloquently. But by the way, the context of this quote I can't even take credit for. I am authorizedly stealing it from the work of a brilliant researcher by the name of Dr. Bill Holland, who I'll talk about later. But without further ado, let me read you about scientific research from Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park. Here we go. You know what's wrong with scientific power? It's a form of inherited wealth. And you know what assholes congenitally rich people are. It never fails. Most kind of power requires substantial sacrifice by whoever wants the power. There is an apprenticeship, a discipline lasting many years. Whatever kind of power you want, president of the company, black belt in karate, spiritual guru. Whatever it is you seek, you have to put in the time, the practice, and the effort. You must give up a lot to get it. It has to be very important to you, and once you have attained it, it is your power. It can't be given away. It resided in you. It is literally the result of your discipline. Now, what is interesting about this process is that by the time someone has acquired the ability to kill with his bare hands, he has also matured to the point where he won't use it unwisely. So that kind of power has a built-in control. The discipline of getting the power changes you so that you won't abuse it. But scientific power is like inherited wealth, attained without discipline. You read what others have done and you take the next step. You can do it very young. You can make progress very fast. There is no discipline lasting many decades. There is no mastery. Old scientists are ignored. There is no humility before nature. There is only a get-rich-quick, make-a-name-for-yourself-fast philosophy. Cheat, lie, falsify, it doesn't matter. Not to you or to your colleagues. No one will criticize you. No one has any standards. They are all trying to do the same thing, to do something big and do it fast. And because you stand on the shoulders of giants, you can accomplish something quickly. You don't even know exactly what you have done, but already you have reported it, patented it, and sold it. And the buyer will have even less discipline than you. The buyer simply purchases the power, like any commodity. The buyer doesn't even conceive that any discipline might be necessary. A karate master does not kill people with his bare hands. He does not lose his temper and kill his wife. The person who kills is the person who has no discipline, no restraint, and who has purchased his power in the form of a Saturday night special. And that is the kind of power that today's science fosters and permits. So with all this in mind, folks, let's take a look at the history of the germ theory. I quote from Dr. Bill Holub's paper, The True Story, Germs, Infections, Epidemics, and Vaccinations. Here is still another chapter which requires a totally new understanding from what you have been told. You are very likely comfortable, after decades of medical germ propaganda, with the simple notion that germs cause infections, which cause epidemics, which require immunizations to cure. After all, isn't that what you learned in nursery school, primary school, high school, college, at the doctor's office, health departments, the media, etc.? Would you be shocked if we told you that almost all that you have learned about germs and disease is not true? But please bear with us as we unfold this extraordinary story. Temporarily suspend all your preconceptions and listen with an open mind, heart, and spirit. What you have learned about germs, disease, epidemics, and immunizations represents 100 years of misunderstanding and opportunism. Organized medicine simply made a mistaken guess about the nature of quote-unquote infectious disease about a century ago. Contemporary medicine has since been building a medical house of cards based upon a non-scientific foundation of ignorance and a few lies. History frequently becomes distorted to suit the needs of current vested interests. This has certainly been true concerning the quote-unquote history of germs, infections, disease, and immunizations. We have all been told about Pasteur, the father of the alleged germ theory of disease. It is a classic medical fairy tale told and retold to all of us, including our children. After all, didn't he save all our children from those horrible childhood and adult epidemics? Why, everyone knows that germs cause disease, right? Wrong. Let's go back and look at another version of those times, and you decide. First of all, the germ theory predated Pasteur by several centuries. In 1546, Geronimo Fracastorio published the first statement about contagion in organisms. But it wasn't until 1683 that the microscope of Anton van Leeuwenhoek produced a visual existence of germs and bacillus. In 1762, M.A. Plensick published a germ theory of infectious disease. He postulated that organisms living outside of our bodies could invade us and cause infection and disease. It does seem, therefore, that Pasteur copied all this information and presented it as his own in 1878. But, ladies and gentlemen, it's not quite that true either. Because, aside from plagiarizing all those other people from centuries and decades before him, Pasteur plagiarized someone else. Let me read you from William James's book, Immunizations, the Reality Behind the Myth, because she has a lot more to say on this subject. Let's go back to the scientific world of about 130 years ago. Scientists were arguing about the origin and nature of living matter and were asking such questions as, what is the thing that causes milk to sour, meat to spoil, and wine to ferment? Where does it come from? Does it come from the air? Does it grow from other matter? Or does it disappear from nowhere? Most scientists believe the thing that caused fermentation appeared from nowhere. This theory was called spontaneous generation. One French scientist, however, proved through experiments in his laboratory that fermentation was the result of living organisms and that these organisms are airborne. They grow in the food and ferment it by a process of their digestion, assimilation, and excretion. Does this sound like I am talking about Louis Pasteur? Read on. The same scientist also discovered that living organisms exist within cells as well as on external surfaces, and that these organisms can cause fermentation as can airborne organisms. Meanwhile, another scientist, a spontifartist, which is one who believes in spontaneous generation of matter, seized upon this first scientist's ideas and claimed them as his own. Being extraordinarily ambitious and with a genius for self-promotion, he popularized as well as plagiarized the original scientist's ideas when he found that his own observations and explanations would not stand up to scrutiny. This plagiarism, the first of many such plagiarisms, would not have been so devastating had the ideas not been oversimplified and distorted. For instance, having realized that airborne microorganisms, later known as bacteria, cause fermentation, he became fixated and sought to explain by germs of the air everything that he had explained before by spontaneous generation. He ignored those microorganisms within the cells of our body that can cause not only fermentation but perform other important biological functions as well. He also taught that these minute organisms were fixed, monomorphic entities, and he divided them into different classes, claiming that each group fermented one kind of food and another fermented another, and so on. This eventually led to the theory that different bacteria cause different diseases. This is the familiar germ theory of disease, of course, and the opportunist and plagiarist was none other than the hallowed Louis Pasteur. This is a heretical idea and is easy to say at this distance in time, but as the facts as set forth by Ethel Douglas Hume in her book show, Bichon for Pasteur, which is the title, the book is extremely well documented. Miss Hume spent years poring over every scientific paper presented by the chemist, Louis Pasteur, and by the chemist, physician, naturalist, and biologist, Professor Pierre-Jacques Antoine Bichon. As she noted their dates, it became clear that Pasteur, who in many instances first ridiculed Bichon's theories, later appropriated them and took full credit for their discovery. Now, the reasons Louis Pasteur's theories, plagiarized theories and distorted theories, were accepted during his day was because, first of all, his theories fit the mechanistic theories of the universe that were popular in the 19th century, and it also fits human nature, because man loves to take responsibility and throw it outside of himself. And the idea that these bad little germs came and flew around and attacked us made a very good scapegoat. And, of course, the third reason was that Louis Pasteur's ideas fit commercial interests. You know, in the case of disease, the cause, our germs, and our protectors is the medical establishment. Hold on a second here, folks. Bill's going to turn the tape over, and we'll be back with you in a minute. Now, since we're in a historical mode here, I'd like to point out that the famous nurse, Florence Nightingale, had already published a powerful attack on the germ theory a full 17 years before Pasteur published his plagiarized and distorted version of the germ theory. I'm reading now from Florence Nightingale's original work, as quoted by Dr. Bill Holub in the same paper I mentioned earlier. Reading on from Florence Nightingale. Diseases are not individuals arranged in classes like cats and dogs, but are conditions growing out of one another. Is it not living in a continual mistake to look upon diseases as we do now as separate entities which must exist like cats and dogs? Instead of looking upon them as conditions, like a dirty and a clean condition, and just as much under our control, or rather as the reactions of a kindly nature against the conditions in which we have placed ourselves. I was brought up by both scientific men and ignorant women, distinctly to believe that smallpox, for instance, was a thing of which there was once a first specimen in the world, which went on propagating itself in a perpetual chain of descent, just as much as there was a first dog or a first pair of dogs, and that smallpox would not begin itself any more than a new dog would begin without there having been a parent dog. Since then, I have seen with my eyes and smelled with my nose smallpox growing up in first specimens, either in closed rooms or in overcrowded wards, where it could not have by any possibility been caught, but must have begun. Nay more, I have seen diseases begin, grow up, and pass into one another. Now, dogs do not pass into cats. I have seen, for instance, with a little overcrowding, continued fever grow up, and with a little more, typhoid fever, and with a little more, typhus, and all in the same ward or hut. Would it not be far better, truer, and more practical if we looked upon disease in this light? For diseases, as all experience shows, are adjective, not noun substantives. True nursing ignores infection, except to prevent it. Cleanliness and fresh air from open windows with unremitting attention to the patient are the only defense a true nurse either asks for or needs. Wise and humane management of the patient is the best safeguard against infection. The greater part of nursing consists in preserving cleanliness. The specific disease doctrine is the grand refuge of the weak, uncultured, unstable minds such as now rule in the medical profession. There are no specific diseases. There are specific disease conditions. I'll bet you didn't know Florence Nightingale argued against the germ theory, folks. Now, let me complete the picture a little bit now. I'm going to read you a little piece about Bernard Bichon, the man who originated the ideas which Pasteur stole and twisted. I'm reading from Wading James's book, Immunizations, The Reality Behind the Myth. Now let us turn to Bichamp and his theories. As we proceed, you will notice that Bichamp's ideas are almost the inverse of Pasteur's. In essence, Bichamp's theories are as follows. The smallest units of living matter are what cytologists have called cell granules, which Bichamp sometimes referred to as granulations of the protoplasm. Bichamp called these organisms microzymas from the Greek word meaning small ferments because they induce fermentation. Not all cell granules are microzymas, however. Microzymas are identifiable because they have some structure and are autonomous. They are the antecedents of cells and the fundamental unit of the corporate organism. Every living being has arisen from the microzyma, and every living being is reducible to the microzyma. To get an idea of their size, we might say that they are to the cell what an electron is to an atom. Microzymas are constantly developing into bacteria. In fact, bacteria are an evolutionary form of microzymas, actually, microzymas fully grown. They develop from the cells of the host organism when that organism dies. So-called virulent or pathogenic bacteria are generated by decaying matter, their function being to reduce or decompose matter back to its constituent elements. When their job is finished, they become microzymas again. Pathogenic bacteria could be thought of as nature's undertakers or cleanup crew. The microorganisms known as disease germs are either diseased microzymas, as Bichamp called them, or their evolutionary bacterial forms. Quoting Bichamp, in a diseased body, a change of function in the microzymas may lead to a morbid bacterial evolution. If tissue is healthy, the microzymas will function to support the life and integrity of the cells. If the cells have been damaged, they will produce morbid or diseased microzymas, which may evolve into pathogenic or disease-producing bacteria. In short, the microzyma has two functions, to build or to disintegrate tissues. Another way of thinking about the functions of microzymas is that they secrete ferments, which aid digestion, and when they encounter dead or damaged cells, they evolve into bacteria. Bichamp found microzymas everywhere, innumerable in healthy tissues, and associated with various kinds of bacteria in diseased tissues. Whether microzymas become healthy and evolve into friendly bacteria, which aid in constructive metabolism, or are diseased and evolve into pathogenic bacteria, depends upon the character of the medium, the cellular fluids upon which they feed. That is, the character of the soil. The health or the unhealth of the host organism is what determines the character of the microorganismic life within it. Bodies in which pathogenic bacteria form are not healthy. Merely fighting and killing bacteria will not bring health, for the condition which gave rise to the bacteria will do so again. Let me read that again, folks, because this is the essence of the fraud that you have been given in reference to the germ theory. This is the reality. I'm going to read it again. Bodies in which pathogenic bacteria form are not healthy. Merely fighting and killing bacteria will not bring health, for the condition which gave rise to the bacteria will do so again. Bichamp showed that bacteria function in whatever medium they find themselves, even changing their shapes as well as their function in accord with that medium. In comparing Pasteur's understanding of bacteria with Bichamp's, J.I. Rodale gives us the following illustration. Pasteur might have commented while looking into a microscope, "Ah, here is the bacteria that ferments beer, and this is its shape." Bichamp might have commented, "Here is a bacteria fermenting beer. In beer, it takes on this shape." In other words, bacteria are pleomorphic, or form-changing, rather than monomorphic, or form-fixed. Bacteria reflect the conditions in which they find themselves, rather than create those conditions. Thus, ladies and gentlemen, the one bacteria for one disease idea is absolute nonsense, and we're going to talk about that more in the next show. Modern medicine, under the spell of the germ theory, tells us that for every disease there is a disease entity, an individual bacteria shaped in a particular way that causes a particular disease.
Bischoff showed through innumerable experiments that not only is the germ we associate with a particular disease a product and not the cause of the disease, but also that what some researchers would call different species of bacteria are really different stages of microzymian evolution into their bacterial forms.
I know this is a lot to digest, folks, and there's a lot of big words in here, but just understand that the basic ideas behind Bischoff's theories is that there are tiny units of life, much smaller than a cell, which are the basis, which evolve into bacterial forms later on, depending upon the medium in which they exist. Bischoff also says that bacteria do not cause disease, germs don't cause disease. They respond to the media they are in. Now, the fact is that what we call germs, being bacteria and viruses and protozoa, function as little garbage men of our bodies. They break down and decompose us and our constituent organs and cellular fluids and all kinds of good stuff when they are unhealthy and toxic. And on the other hand, they also participate in the building process of our body. Now, the microzymas is a funny word, and I'm sure it throws a lot of you, but don't worry about it, because what we're really talking about here, and the connection will be made hopefully in the next show, which you're going to hear tomorrow night, I hope you'll all listen, is that microzymas are very close to what modern medicine is calling genes and genetic material. And this is where I'm going to make the connection with the fraud about viruses, folks, including AIDS. But not to get too far off the subject, I'm going to clarify some of what I just read by citing the work of Dr. Henry Lindlar, who's a doctor alive around 1918. And his quotes and his discussions of Bischoff are very interesting. Quote, "The physical characteristics and vital activities of cells and germs depend upon the soil in which their microzymas feed, grow, and multiply. Thus, microzymas growing in the soil of procreative germplasm develop into normal, permanent, specialized cells of a living vegetable, animal, or human organism. The same microzymas feeding on morbid material and systemic poisons in these living bodies develop into bacteria and parasites." I am now going to quote another early proponent of Bischoff's work, that is one Dr. E.C. Rosenau, who was working in the Mayo Biological Laboratories in 1910. He did a series of experiments in which he took bacterial strains from all different disease sources, things like arthritis, tonsillitis, cow's milk, and mixed them all up and put them in a culture of uniform media, and what he says here is interesting, quote, "After a while, there was no difference between the germs. They all became one class. Now, you may think, oh, well, one strain overrode the others and took over. Well, that's not what happened, because it was a very well-controlled experiment. And, folks, these experiments have been repeated over and over again, but it's very strange that we are being taught a very, very distorted view of how germs and disease function. Now, Dr. Rosenau did some other very interesting work in this field. Reading from Wading James' book, Rosenau demonstrated that, quote, "simple bacterial forms like streptococci, which are pus germs, could be made to assume all of the characteristics of pneumococci, which are pneumonia germs, simply by feeding them on pneumonia virus and making other minor modifications in their environment. And when Rosenau reversed the procedure and fed pneumonia germs on pus, they quickly changed into streptococci. Many other experiments were carried on, and in every instance, the germs, regardless of type, changed into other types when their food and environment were altered. In other words, Rosenau found that various strains of bacteria, or what one might call subspecies of them, could, when suitably treated, become any of the other strains." Now, back to Dr. Raymond Reif of San Diego, who I mentioned earlier, who had built that fantastic light microscope that made living germs and viral material visible for the first time, before or since, actually. Quoting again from Wading James's book, Reif showed that by altering the environment and food supply, friendly germs such as colon bacillus
can be converted into pathogenic germs such as typhoid, and that this process is reversible. Experiments conducted in Rice laboratories established the fact that the virus of cancer, like the viruses of other diseases, can be easily changed from one form to another by means of altering the media upon which it is grown. With the first change in media, the BX virus becomes considerably enlarged, although its purplish-red color remains unchanged. Observation of the organism with an ordinary microscope is made possible by a second alteration of the media. A third change is undergone upon asparagus-based media, where the BX virus is transformed from its filterable state into Cryptomyces pleomorphia fungi. These fungi being identical morphologically both macroscopically and microscopically to that of the orchid and of the mushroom. And yet a fourth change may be said to take place when this Cryptomyces pleomorphia, permitted to stand as a stock culture for a period, becomes the well-known mahogany-colored Bacillus coli. By altering the media, 4 parts per million per volume, the pure culture of mahogany-colored Bacillus coli becomes the turquoise-blue Bacillus typhosis. Simply stated, folks, this means that the virus of cancer can be easily changed into the type of bacteria that normally inhabits our colon, and it can also be changed into destructive bacteria of typhoid simply by slightly altering the media in which it is grown. And remember, folks, our bodies and the substances and the constituents of our cellular fluids are the media in which bacteria grow in our bodies. Now, since this is indeed the single greatest fraud slash misunderstanding in all of medical history, before I go any further, folks, I want to be sure that everything is clear in your mind, and I'm going to read now a summary from Dr. Bill Holub, who I've quoted throughout the show here, because it is very understandable, very concrete, and yet very simple. Reading from Bill Holub's work, Bichamp called these microscopic creatures microzymas, and he found them everywhere, in healthy and diseased tissues, in plants, and in rocks, and in the air. He determined that they were the elemental unit of life, not the cell, and that all living organisms were simply associations of these living entities. He further said that their presence was necessary for cell growth, repair, and long-term survival. Today's microzymas are all direct descendants of prehistoric ancestors, changed only by the changes in the Earth's total environment. These microzymas are immortal and are always ready to rebuild, to heal, to rework body wastes, or to decompose you, depending upon whether you are well-nourished or not. They have the same functions as those found in the soil or sewage or anywhere in nature, and they have never, ever been shown to attack healthy tissues. One must remember the climate of medicine at the time. It was just prior to the discovery of germs that medicine literally believed in evil spirits as the cause of disease, without realizing that the symptoms of disease are actually the body in healing action. Medicine sought an explanation for these observed phenomena, acting mostly from fear of the unknown, but also from fear of death, pain, and loss of control. Medicine postulated the theory that illness came from outside of the individual in the form of a foreign invader. Of course, there was and still isn't any scientific evidence whatsoever for these foreign invaders, but medicine persists because now the foreign invader idea has economic support. Think of it. If medicine can convince you that diseases caused by these foreign invaders, be they evil spirits or germs or cancer cells, then they can also convince you that you have no power over them and only medicine can save you. They may also convince you that nothing you do to change your lifestyle will affect your disease, and so they are able to sell you an endless variety of products and services, which is drugs and surgery. In a very real sense, medicine still believes in evil spirits because germs are today's evil spirits. Supposedly, germs come from outside of you and possess your body to give you illness, pain, and death. Only medicine, of course, has the special magical potions in the form of drugs and surgery to cure you. They want you to feel powerless so that they can take the power in their own hands and the money too, of course. Pasteur's germ theory fit today's medical bill, so they are determined to hold on to it, despite scientific proof to the contrary from every corner. You see, if these evil germs cause disease, then you can't blame air pollution, drugs, medication, junk food, and a variety of other profitable businesses. Imagine if medicine accepted the true germ theory of Bichamp. The behavior of germs then becomes a consequence of the degree of our nourishing ourselves and our world. Then medicine would have nothing to sell you except the truth, and at the moment, they fear that no one would buy it. The truth that they could sell is that disease is simply a sign that your body is healing and that your cooperation and that of the germs is required to complete the job. Just think, then doctors would have to start talking to you about diet, supplements, exercise, spirit, heart and mind, and true healing. They would have to start helping you heal rather than helping you to decompose. Interestingly, in this battle between Pasteur and Bichamp, it has been reported that just before Pasteur died, he admitted that Bichamp's germ theory is the correct one, i.e., that germs are a consequence of their environment and hence a result of disease and not a cause of disease. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's also an interesting coincidence that Louis Pasteur is the father of vaccinations. You've heard, I hope, well, maybe you haven't, but if you went through some basic high school or college biology, you know about his experiments on anthrax and rabies, which he allegedly cured. But the facts are that Pasteur caused more anthrax and rabies with his vaccinations and killed more people than history would care to admit. The other legacy that our friend Louis Pasteur has left us is the wonderful process of pasteurization. Because remember, Pasteur gave us the germ theory, and germs are bad, so we have to kill them in our food. He was the one who got us to pasteurize milk. Now, I'm going to get into this when I talk about a show on nutrition, but just for fun, I'll mention it to you now. Pasteurized milk spoils faster than raw milk, and that is because the protective bacteria that will actually help the milk last longer are killed by pasteurization. Now, pasteurization is stupid to begin with because the temperatures were required about 190 to 230 degrees Celsius and needed to kill typhoid and tuberculosis. And they can never heat milk that high because it just totally destroys it. But by their little pasteurization methods that they use now, they destroy all nourishing nutrients in milk and other juices and other foods that they pasteurize, including 20% of the available iodine, most of the fat-soluble and water-soluble vitamins. And I hope none of you out there really believe that milk is a source of calcium, because raw milk is a source of calcium, but pasteurized milk is not a source of calcium. In fact, it drains calcium from your bones because the pasteurization process renders the proteins in milk highly indigestible and toxic, and in order to balance the acidic pH condition which drinking milk creates in your bloodstream, it causes a calcium drain on your body. Well, so much for Louis Pasteur. Tomorrow night, folks, I'm going to go into this in detail, and I'm going to bring it to the present day. We are going to talk about modern diseases. We are going to go further into the reality, into the real data about the germ theory. And following that, we're going to talk about AIDS. So, I hope you'll tune in tomorrow. I'm sure you will like what you hear. I know tonight was a bit historic and a bit maybe boring, but it's a background that was necessary to give you. Again, if there is anything that I've mentioned on the show that you would like to know about or want to correspond with me about, or you have information that you think I would be interested in, or you think I'm full of crap and you want to argue with me, you can write to me. That's Alex Loglia, L-O-G-L-I-A, 217 East 85th Street, Suite 246, New York, New York, 10028. More importantly, though, I would love to get out what information I have to anyone who wants it. And I do have tons about vaccinations, about germs and disease, about AIDS, about everything in that area. That's Alex Loglia, L-O-G-L-I-A, 217 East 85th Street, Suite 246, New York, New York, 10028. You can include a phone number if you want, but you don't have to. I'll get back to everybody.
as much as is possible. Take care, folks. Good night. And I hope you'll tune in tomorrow night. Bye-bye.
Well, I like that, Alex. Well, that's enough of Pasteur. Folks, I hope you enjoyed tonight's broadcast. Again, we'd like to thank Alex Loglia for his great research and all of the information that he has collected for CAGI and for these wonderful broadcasts that he occasionally blesses us with. Good night. Make sure that you're here tomorrow night for part two, and God bless you all.
Howdy, folks. Hope you heard last night's show, because tonight I am continuing with the germ theory topic. I'm going to begin with a quote from the work of Dr. Bill Holub, who I had mentioned yesterday. All of his work is very well documented, and what you're about to hear is the nexus of 30 years of work. Yet it is simple, clear, direct, and profound. Pay attention, folks. Here is the up-to-date proof of the absolute idiocy of the germ theory, and also a glimpse at the reality of what the phenomenon that we call disease consists of. Now, remember what I spoke of yesterday. Bacteria and viruses are not form-fixed. They mutate and change according to the medium they are in. They are with us, inside of us constantly, and function both to build tissue and to decompose waste. And remember also that what we call disease is the elimination of toxins that we take in. Germs appear when our body is eliminating these toxins because the medium becomes conducive to them. They are not the cause, however. Germs are not the cause of disease. They come out of our very substance. They are not from the outside. You don't catch anything. They come from within. And Bichamp showed this very clearly in his work. Again, I will refer you to Bichamp or Pasteur, the book by Hume. It is very interesting and is a rather wonderful piece of biological history there. But let me go on with Bill Holub here, again from the work that I was quoting yesterday. This chapter is entitled, "The New Germ Theory is Supported by the New Biology." Let us bring all this historical information up to the knowledge we have today. We need here to define and explain three terms: germs, genetics, and evolution. Germs. We are defining germs here to include all manner of microorganisms, including viroids, viruses, bacteria, fungus, protozoa, etc. The new information from molecular biology, biochemistry, and many other fields of research all support this proper view of the role of germs in human health. Dr. Lewis Thomas, in the book Lives of a Cell, says of viruses, quote, "Instead of being single-minded agents of disease and death, they now begin to look more like mobile genes. We live in a dancing matrix of viruses. They dart, rather like bees, from organism to organism, from plant to insect to mammal to me and back again and into the sea, transplanting grafts of DNA passing around heredity as though at a great party. They may be the mechanism for keeping new mutant kinds of DNA in the widest possible circulation among us." And let me just remind you of what Bichamp had said many, many years ago, which I mentioned yesterday, about the microzymas, because indeed modern research clearly indicates that what Bichamp was seeing as microzymas are viruses and viral material. Moving on with Bill Holub. Germs are one-celled
protozoa, or subcellular parts of whole cells, which are basically immortal and have been in existence since the origin of life on this planet. They were here long before we were, so there was nothing to attack then, just as they attack nothing now. They are the basic unit of life, and in a sense, then, we are a collection or living condominium of attached germs surviving as a group because of cooperation. Germs, then, are an integral and vital part of our function, including growth, maintenance, and repair. They are also our links to the cycle of life on this planet. Thus, they begin to recycle our structure whenever we allow that malnourished situation to occur. But realize that they would not and could not attack you. It would be like attacking themselves, and this would never occur. As Aristotle pointed out, quote, "Nature does nothing uselessly," and Zeno concurred, "The goal of life is living in agreement with nature." Germs do not attack. They assist in healing and have the facility to do things which the remainder of our cells and tissues cannot do. They synthesize much of our needed vitamins and other nutrients. They help to detoxify dangerous substances from our environment. They provide a needed communication with our environment, both internal and external. They help in our constant adaptation to a constantly changing environment. They even allow for the exchange of important information from one part of our body to another, and from one organism to another, and from one person to another. God knows we need the germs, for they are us. Genetics. Genes are part of the cell that ensure the immortality of the cell. They transmit the needed current information to help one-celled or the multi-celled organism, which is people, survive. However, we used to be taught that once you, quote-unquote, inherited something, it is unchangeable, but this is not so. Much recent high-tech research has shown that there is a constant interplay between genes and their environment. This means that genes affect potential characteristics. The actual expression of any gene is dependent upon environmental factors, including nutrition, light, toxins, etc. Some excellent work reported in 1985 in the July 20th edition of Science News, that is, by L. Reed, reaffirms once again that the environment in which a cell exists determines its survival and behavior. By manipulating cell culture media, they succeeded in mimicking liver cells in various healthy and diseased states. They showed that the matrix in which a cell or a human finds themselves influences the regulation of cell growth and specialization by turning on certain genes while turning off others. Thus, you do not inherit diseases, but inherit potential blueprints for the healthy state. By heeding the blueprints and using the right or nourishing building material, the healthy state can be achieved. However, if you try to work outside of the blueprints or use inferior materials for your construction, such as junk food, medications, etc., then poor health will surely result. Viruses, viroids, and the like appear to be a way to transmit and change the genetic makeup of organisms like us in order to ensure survival. We may very well be making viruses by spin-off material from our cells, which are more like stuck-together viruses anyway. Evolution. By evolution, we simply mean the gradual changes in organisms and their environment, which occur always. These changes represent adaptations of an organism to its constantly changing environment. They include a wide range of cyclic changes, for example, day and night, lunar cycles, seasons, etc. They also include longer geological and population and social changes which may occur in cycles of decades or centuries. Thus, the various organisms which we see inhabiting man are really adaptive changes in the organisms in response to changes to their changing environment, namely you. You are the changing environment for these quote-unquote germs and bacteria. Understand that, folks. Germs change in response to your nourishment status. If you are well nourished, then certain germs flourish. If you are poorly nourished, then other kinds of germs grow, which also adapt to the different metabolic situations in your body.
Just to give you a simple example, if you become malnourished, then less oxygen and nutrients get to your cells and they die off at a more rapid rate, leaving protein and other types of cell waste byproducts. All this provides food for certain quote-unquote new versions of microbes which can survive in low oxygen, low nutrient, high nitrogen waste circumstances. So, the germs didn't suddenly invade you and make you sick. They simply changed to adapt to your sickness. Again, germs are a consequence of disease, not the cause. So if you go on a fast or follow other natural healing modalities, the nature of the germs change back to those found in the healthy state. The germs have always been and shall always be. They are here sharing this world with us and help us when we need them. They are ancient and they are immortal. A recent article in The Lancet by John Heyman combines microbiology and paleontology to show that a particular germ, Mycobacterium ulcerans, is at least more than 200 million years old and inhabits the same regions of the Earth as part of the continents that were once connected but have long since separated, which is South America, Africa, and Australia. Germs as guardian angels, infection as a healing event. If we accept, as I think we must, that germs are not here to give us pain or to kill us, why would they want to kill their host, or to create the antibiotic vaccination industry, then why are they here? We believe we have the answer to this question, and the answer is something wonderful, not something to fear. Germs are part and parcel of the healing process. That's right, they are participating in the healing process. Just look at what they are capable of doing and see how they can participate in healing. They are able to break down waste products of our metabolism and of our cellular debris. They can exist on low oxygen or even no oxygen, which are anaerobes. They can break down toxic substances in our body that we could not break down, such as plastics, pesticides, artificial ingredients, toxic waste, etc. Furthermore, let us not forget that they also provide a good deal of our vitamin supply by their ability to synthesize vitamins inside us, including B12, niacin, vitamin K, vitamin C, etc. Now, isn't this a blessing in disguise? Another very important role, especially for viroids, which are smaller than viruses, and viruses themselves, is their potential role in helping our cells to adapt to a rapidly changing environment and to transmit, or better, share this information from cell to cell in your body. Think of the marvelous system that allows a virus to use and alter the genetic makeup of one of our cells and then share this information with thousands of other cells. Modern medicine calls this infection, folks. Viroids, which are tiny particles of DNA or RNA, much smaller than viruses, have been studied extensively in plants because they cause non-commercial mutations of potatoes, tomatoes, etc. But studies have shown that these viroids have only started affecting crops subject to 20th century high-tech agriculture with its total alienation of natural processes. It's the old story. When you seriously alter the natural development of an organism by inbreeding, artificial feeding, chemical fertilizers, toxic exposure, mechanical harvesting, etc., you create the need for these germ-assisted alterations. However, these alterations are for the survival of the organism. Of course, for the organism to survive, say a potato, it may not resemble the potato that people are used to buying and eating. But nature is not concerned with aesthetic appeal, but with survival and immortality. How does this help you? We are writing this in late spring, and people around us are complaining about runny noses, coughs, etc., all caused, supposedly, by a bug that is going around. Here is what is really happening. Spring brings out green growth and the weeds and insects that go along with it. This brings out America's arsenal of chemical fertilizers, lime, weed killers, bug killers, etc. This toxic insult to our environment brings about the need for significant healing and adaptation amongst all of us exposed to it. The quote-unquote colds, runny nose, cough, etc. are your body's way of dumping the toxic material out, and here is where the germs play a critical role. While the bacteria are busy digesting away some of these toxic substances inside of us, the viruses are transmitting the information on how we may adapt to this toxic onslaught. Viruses enter and replicate in those cells of ours which can survive the toxic exposure, and as the virus replicates in other cells, it, in essence, is transmitting this survival advantage to thousands of our cells. Companies have even smartened up to the fact that germs participate in healing and are trying to steal and market their powers. A Dr. Todaro from Oncogene Incorporated describes a growth factor from vaccinia virus, which is smallpox, which can significantly enhance wound healing. Germs are part of our healing, and we would do well to work with them. The myth of contagion and transmission of disease. This updated version of medicine's old evil spirits and spells suits their non-humanistic and high-tech mechanistic treatment of patients today. It's very simple. As we have already indicated, all germs are ubiquitous, present in everyone, everywhere, all the time. Each person has their own private collection of germs suitable to them specifically, so if they are to become ill, they have plenty of their own bugs. They couldn't and wouldn't catch them from anyone. We are not saying here that germs don't move about the environment, but rather that they do not jump from one person to another to produce illness. In fact, all of the information about epidemics seems to prove that there is no transmission of germs occurring. For example, why do most quote-unquote epidemics occur in winter when people are less exposed publicly to each other? Why do epidemics strike large numbers of people at the same time and never show a spreading type of incidence which one would expect to see if indeed germs are being transmitted from person to person? Why is it that regions that have large interchanges of people, like New York and Florida, do not show the infections following the people? Why do epidemics frequently follow patterns around holidays, like Thanksgiving or Christmas? Do germs know that these are holidays? What is really happening with these supposed epidemics is the following. Actually, the word epidemic from the Greek means literally on or at, and people, and means something that happens to people as a group all at once, not a slow contagion. The actual epidemic process is very simple. Remember that everyone already has their daily complement of germs, and remember also that a large population of people, such as a town, a region, or city, is constantly being exposed to the same environmental hazards all at the same time. For example, large numbers of people are exposed to the same weather changes, water quality changes, pesticides, food and water, contaminated food of a fast food chain, bad news in the media, batches of drugs and medication, holiday moods, air quality changes, and many other toxic insults. The quote-unquote group healing reaction to these toxic challenges is what you are seeing when people start coughing, sneezing, or whatever. They are not catching it from each other. They are experiencing it with others. In addition, at many levels, we are all connected. About the only thing that is catching about all of this is paranoia. After all, medicine has had about a century to literally instill the fear of germs into our culture. So people fear the germs in the air, in the water. They fear germs from touching people, which in turn leads to our general fear of people. When they read or see reports about infections going around, so to speak, the fear, paranoia, and anticipation has been shown to lower immunity and precipitate illness. Now, isn't that interesting? Our self-imposed stress about holidays has the same effect. Another important facet of this germology, which shocks so many people, is that science actually cannot isolate the germ involved in any disease. What they isolate is a version of the original, and in the case of viruses, that version may actually bear very little or no resemblance to the original germ in somebody's body. This means that as soon as you start the process of isolating and identifying a germ, you totally lose the feature of the original copy. Recall that germs reproduce very rapidly and also mutate or change themselves very rapidly as their environment changes. Thus, the very involved process of culturing and transfer involved in the science of microbiology totally changes the germ so that by the time it is isolated for study, it is no longer the germ that was originally taken from the human subject. What we study about germs in tissue, cell, or media culture has nothing to do with their activity in the human. So you can't prove that the original germ is causing anything. This paradoxical problem in biology is known by any good scientist. Namely, that the study changes the circumstances and, at least as far as germs go, one cannot study them in their natural habitat. The problem is exemplified by you trying to catch your own shadow in the shape it is at any moment. As soon as you make a move to trap your shadow, it changes its shape. Therefore, you can never really see what your shadow looks like without changing it, and the same is true for germs. Still another problem is quantity of germs. If germs are not in quantity, they cannot be proven to exist in a human. This means that everyone has a few thousand herpes organisms alive in them, but that number is undetectable by science. Yet another problem is the presence of antibodies to germs. Unfortunately, this proves nothing at all. It could mean you have a lot of the certain organism, or some, or very little, or none. You cannot link antibody titers to presence or absence of infection at all.
Again, that was from the work of Dr. Bill Holub, folks. Now, I'm sure a lot of questions are raised in your mind. Everybody who hears this stuff gets all upset, and they say, what about massive epidemics? What about the Black Plague? All that kind of stuff. I love the Black Plague as an example. I mean, you're talking about large-scale, quote-unquote, epidemic devastating Europe, blaming it on little flea and the organism that was going through the flea and the rats. But remember, folks, you're talking about a time in Europe when people were eating lard pies three meals a day and the sewer was out in the street. Think about that. Think about the plagues of very early times in Rome and up through now to modern history, and I can, every example I can give you reasons why those things occurred. My other argument I get is, what about polio? What about syphilis? What about aseptic meningitis, AIDS? Well, we're going to talk about that in the next two shows, because I'm going to dedicate the next two shows to AIDS specifically. It's really the single greatest medical fraud that I have ever seen. But if you look at polio, and as I had mentioned on the show for vaccines, you will find that the definitions for the symptoms of non-paralytic polio match almost precisely to the symptoms for aseptic meningitis, which match almost exactly to what we are now classifying as AIDS. It's the same old renaming game, folks. It's the renaming game, and I can show you that what we are calling AIDS has been around for years. Now remember, AIDS is acquired immune deficiency syndrome, and they are saying that it is caused by a new virus called HIV. Hopefully, over the next two shows after this one, I will show you that HIV causes nothing. But get it fixed in your mind from what I just read, folks, that germs do not cause disease. Epidemics are caused by a lot of different things, but have nothing to do with germs and viruses. They are a consequence, not the cause. If you want to look for causes of particular diseases, I suggest you start with looking at immunization programs, and that has been a fun little project of mine. But you can trace most of the major quote-unquote epidemics of our age, including cancer, to vaccinations. AIDS is a fun one. We're going to talk about it another time, so I'm not going to belabor that point with discussion right now. The next thing I am going to read you is a little excerpt from another piece of Dr. Bill Holub's work about germs and disease. And it's a portion relating to Dr. Holub's specific explanation about herpes as an example of a specific disease and how the theory that we call the germ theory really cannot apply and does not apply. So, at this point, let Bill take his break, and we'll flip the tape over in a little while, and we'll be back in a few minutes with the work from Dr. Bill Holub on herpes. As we have already explained previously, germs do not cause disease, but are a consequence of it. Germs,
including viruses, viroids, bacteria, fungus, etc., are an essential feature of the cycling of matter in our world. Remember that each and every speck of substance that makes you up is simply recycled from our environment through eating, breathing, and drinking. That's why God, as nature, has placed germs on Earth, to continue the natural cycling of material. If we could destroy all germs on Earth, then all life, including the human race, would cease to exist. So germs perform a useful imperative function. They are not here to create disease, fear, infection, epidemics, or the medical pharmaceutical industry's profits. It is a simple process of recycling. When a person becomes chronically malnourished, nourishment, of course, meaning the natural balance of all inputs required to sustain optimum health, i.e., water, food, activity, love, touch, spiritual stuff, etc., the germs which have always resided in the body view that person as food or organic matter which needs to be recycled. If the person becomes sufficiently malnourished, then they may die, and all manner of germs will proliferate upon them. But those germs did not kill them. They died from severe malnourishment, and the germs only began their job of recycling the material of the body. Therefore, herpes is an innocent bystander, only doing its recycling job when you begin to become malnourished. Herpes is not the enemy. It did not invade or attack. It has no goal of creating misery and pain. It has no reason to proliferate on a person unless they become malnourished enough. And I will add, malnourished enough to change the medium, the body, that the herpes is in, so that it can proliferate. Continuing with Dr. Holub, the person with herpes, AIDS, or cancer is their own enemy. You cannot catch herpes. That's right. You cannot catch herpes because you always had it. Germs are ubiquitous in our environment, which means that every single person always has them as part of their structure from birth. So even though germs always move about in our environment and from person to person, they are already present in everyone. That's right. Even if you think that you were never exposed to or quote-unquote had herpes, botulism, syphilis, strep, etc., you already have them inside you. Realize that every last part of your body is always teeming inside and out with trillions of different germs. They live on you as we live on this planet. So why doesn't everyone get herpes? Remember, herpes only will proliferate on a person that is sufficiently malnourished. Malnourishment can also be viewed as a result of bad balancing of toxic intakes, smoking, drugs, medications, etc., with nutrient intakes like water, food, vitamins, sun, etc. States of malnourishment are similar in people, in countries, communities, neighborhoods, families, workplaces, and relationships. Because malnourishment is so widespread, it is not at all unusual for two people or 1,000 people to develop herpes around the same time. But remember that they did not give it to each other. They all already had herpes laying around, sleeping inside them, waiting for the call to duty. Their duty being the simple recycling job. Malnourishment simply wakes them up and gets them to work. Why herpes? Could medical immunizations be to blame? In the world of germs, just as in the world of people, there is a hierarchy of existence. So trillions of germs are always competing for turf throughout our environment and within all of us. At any one point in time, the germ that happens to be on the top of the heap, so to speak, will be the one to proliferate on all those malnourished people. This occurs over long spans of time, which medicine refers to as epidemics. What medicine does not understand is that these popular germs come and go as a natural process, and they are not contagious by natural routes of exposure, and they are not at all stopped by immunizations or vaccination programs of recent history, which you heard on my last show, or the show before that, rather. In fact, it is interesting to note that the current herpes simplex virus is a very close companion and relative to the cytomegalic inclusion virus, which has been linked with AIDS, and to the virus of infectious mononucleosis, and to the poliomyelitis virus. That's the poliomyelitis virus. America may well be suffering from unusual and unnatural germs inoculated into us by the 1950s polio vaccine program, which not only created an increase in polio cases, which were already disappearing at the time, as I noted, but may have left America in a typical 30-year legacy being experienced as the current epidemics. I should point out that similar vaccine-introduced viruses have been implicated in cancer, particularly in children. So, quote-unquote, modern medicine, through ignorance of natural processes, may have given man not freedom from specific infectious diseases, but rather a series of synthetically altered germs introduced into our bodies in ways nature could not have foreseen. Now, with medicine meddling with genetic engineering of germs, they may yet develop a germ whose job may be to destroy mankind. A germ made by man, not God. We should all hope not. Now, on this note, I'm going to read you a bit about some of the more nefarious characters in the world of modern medical research. Let me read you a bit about Dr. Wolf Smunis from Dr. William Campbell Douglas's book, AIDS, The End of Civilization, I believe, is the title. Very interesting stuff. Dr. Smunis was a Polish Jew who supposedly ended up in a Siberian labor camp during World War II. But after the war, he somehow became a privileged person, was sent to a medical school in Tomsk, Russia, and married a Russian woman. Hardly typical treatment of an enemy of the Soviet state. Smunis' biographer said that Wolf was always reluctant to discuss, quote-unquote, those dark years in Siberia. Maybe he was reluctant because he wasn't in Siberia. If he was, he certainly wasn't shoveling salt. In 1959, the Soviet government allowed him to practice in Poland in a public health capacity. Standard policy in all communist countries is never to allow all members of a family to travel out of the country to the West at the same time. This eliminates 98% of all defection attempts. I have physician friends in Hungary, for example. He can go to a meeting anywhere in the world if she stays home. She can go if he stays home. They can both go if the children are left at home. But in 1969, the entire Smunis family was allowed by Communist Poland to go to a medical meeting in Italy. At that time, they quote-unquote defected and moved to New York City. With no American credentials whatsoever, he immediately got a job as a lab technician at the New York City Blood Center. Within a few years, this Polish immigrant was given his own lab. A separate department of epidemiology was created for him at the blood bank, and he, like the chrysalis turning into a butterfly, changed into a full professor of epidemiology at the Columbia Medical School. Curiouser and curiouser. In 6 years, this lab tech became a full professor and then went back to Moscow for a scientific presentation and was received as a dignitary, not a defector. Well, we tell you this amazing story because in retrospect it is obvious that Wolf Smunis was a carefully groomed communist agent planted here after years of preparation to instigate biological warfare against the American people. Smunis, with full cooperation and financial support of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and the National Institute of Health, masterminded the hepatitis B vaccine experimental program used on homosexual men. He insisted that only young, promiscuous homosexuals be allowed to participate in the experiment. The experiment started in New York at the blood bank in November 1978. The experimental vaccine was produced in a government-supervised laboratory. The study was completed in October 1979. Within 10 years, most of these young men would be dead or dying from AIDS. In 1980, the program was expanded to major cities all across the U.S., In the fall of 1980, the first AIDS cases was reported in San Francisco. 8 years later, most of the homosexuals in San Francisco were infected, dead, or dying. In 1986, Dr. Clad Stevens, one of Smunis' collaborators, penned an astonishing report that did not make your local newspaper. She reported that the majority of the homosexuals in the experimental program were infected with the AIDS virus. The AIDS-laced vaccine, through the bridge of bisexual men, now infects as many as 3 million Americans. Mission accomplished. Now, folks, Let me just add that the end part of this about the AIDS-infected, AIDS-based vaccine, I have yet to find the documentation that supports that. I am not saying that it does not exist. But I have to tell you that the conclusions that Dr. Douglas arrived about the AIDS epidemic are not in harmony with my own findings, and I'll talk about that on my show about AIDS. But I want you to keep all this in the back of your mind. Like I said, I don't totally agree with Dr. Douglas' conclusions, but you'll hear about that tomorrow. You'll see clearly, and I'm sure you may see clearly now, vaccinations do not need to be laced with anything. The simple fact of injecting virulent free-floating proteins and viral material into the bloodstream is more than enough. Now, I don't doubt that billions are spent by governments worldwide to produce all kinds of nasty diseases and cancer-producing stuff, but you must realize that the reality of how the body functions is not understood even by these scientists who may have amazing understandings of microbiology, virology, and immunology. Let's move on and leave it for tomorrow's show. I'm going to read a bit more from Dr. Douglas's book, which, by the way, is an incredible piece of research, very well documented. And again, it's called AIDS, The End of Civilization. Just for fun, I'm going to share some very interesting bits and pieces of information with you. What the Soviet propagandists didn't say was that their agents had been working in our top security biological warfare laboratories for over 20 years. In a burst of brotherly love, they were invited in by President Richard Nixon. The astounded communist scientists from Russia, the Eastern Bloc, and communist China, who had been trying to penetrate this vital security area for 40 years, quickly accepted. They had been snickering in their beakers ever since, while they prepare for our demise. It is no secret that they are there. Dr. Carlton Gegesek, a top official at the Fort Detrick Laboratory, said in Omni magazine in March 1986, "In the facility I have a building where more good and loyal communist scientists from the USSR and mainland China work, with full passkeys to all the labs, than there are Americans. Even the Army's infectious disease unit is loaded with foreign workers, not always friendly nationals." You can't put it more plainly than that. Even the Greeks weren't that stupid. They didn't know the Trojan horse was full of soldiers. When it became obvious to the communist press that we were getting the truth out about who was running things at Fort Detrick, they completely reversed themselves and said it was all a mistake. Everything was just fine at Fort Detrick. Moving on, a little down the road here. You are probably not aware that the International AIDS Prevention Program of the World Health Organization is run by the Soviets. You don't believe it? Call WHO and ask them who is in charge in Europe. If you want to save your nickel, I'll tell you now. He's a Russian named Bysenko, and he operates out of Copenhagen. I am not sure of the spelling of his name, but I can tell you he spells deep trouble for the West. The Soviets control the response to AIDS of the entire free world at many levels, including the top. Dr. Sergei Litvinov, the coordinator of all task force work on AIDS at the World Health Organization, is a high official in the Soviet Ministry of Health. Litvinov gave out the order to our scientists and medical organizations in the Western world not to discuss the real cause of the AIDS epidemic. Now, bear in mind, of course, folks, that Dr. Douglas is of the belief that it was created right here in Fort Detrick, and he puts forth a lot of evidence for that. We'll talk about that tomorrow. At a secret meeting between the editors of The Lancet, the highly respected British medical publication, and a group of the leading retrovirologists of the world, it was decided not to publish any academic discussions about the possible artificial creation of the AIDS virus in a lab. They particularly agreed not to make any mention of world-renowned biologist Isaac Farlane Burnett's published remarks that molecular biology may get out of hand like atomic physics and be used for evil purposes. Now, other medical journals, such as Science and the JAMA, have lockstep with Lancet and put all references to the man-made origins of AIDS down the memory hole. Did Comrade Litvinov have a little talk with the retrovirologists? They, of course, wouldn't need any encouragement from their Soviet UN bosses to attempt a little cover-up for their own heinous crime. But Lancet, The British Medical Journal and the New England Journal of Medicine are another matter. It took some powerful and sinister forces indeed to get these respected publications to cover up the crime of the millennium. The notable exception to this appalling censorship of mass murder is Professor Harding Raines, editor of Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine. Raines refers to a, quote, conspiracy of silence, covering the allegation that AIDS was man-made. I hope Dr. Raines is watching his backside. Now, Dr. Zorys A. Medvedev, unlike Vitenko and Litvinov, supposedly is a Russian exile. Medvedev operates out of London at the National Institute for Medical Research. He's a senior research scientist in the genetics division. He, like Smunis, blossomed from a poor exile into a man of power and influence. Medvedev, before he was exiled, was head of radiobiology at a top-secret Soviet medical research center. Since when do the Soviets exile a key scientist in the field that will be decisive in World War III, which is radiobiology? There's a lot more about this now British citizen and respectable scientist who continues to communicate freely with his supposed enemies in the Soviet biowarfare labs. We'll tell you more later. Medvedev is spreading the disinformation that AIDS is rampant in Russia due to the escape of the virus from a laboratory, a sort of biological Chernobyl. This tends to divert suspicion away from Litvinov, Smoothness, and the other Reds that President Nixon allowed to penetrate our biological laboratories at Fort Detrick. Having the Soviets, quote, control the spread of AIDS in the West has led to some interesting paradoxes. Our masters at the UN tell us that there shall be absolutely no restriction on travel between various parts of the non-communist world. Koop supports the Soviet policy of biological suicide. Are those the instructions he received when he made his trip to Moscow, where the WHO had set up its main AIDS research center? A very interesting question. But our Soviet protectors in the WHO tell us this open policy of international travel does not apply to the communist bloc of nations. If you or I were to visit Moscow and tested positive for AIDS virus, pow, out on the next plane. If they stay clean through their immigration policies and we die because of the immigration policies imposed on us through the UN-controlled World Health Organization, who needs atomic bombs for conquest? Unless the Western world gets its act together and closes down the UN, especially its genocide division called the WHO, freedom and decency will disappear from the planet Earth. But the problem goes much deeper. How do you close down the U.S. government laboratories such as the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, and the National Institute of Health, and the Fort Detrick Biowarfare Lab when the perpetrators of the crime are in control at all levels? I don't know the answer. I thought that was a rather interesting little quote there from Dr. Douglas. Now, again, I want to stress to you that I read that piece to let you know about some of the machinations that are going on in the world of medical research. I don't agree with almost anything that Dr. Douglas believes about AIDS because it just not has stood up under my research. I read this section a bit guardedly and with a little bit of a devious intention. Dr. Douglas has indeed done some fantastic research, and his book is fantastic. It's definitely something to check out. But my opinion is that his approach is a bit misguided. Now, I understand his outrage at discovering all of this insidious conspiring against the populations of the Earth, but my own research, and more importantly, my own personal experience, points me in another direction regarding AIDS. Folks, HIV does not cause AIDS. AIDS is an unbelievable scam, a hoax, a mirage. And remember, when we're talking about AIDS, we're talking about something called acquired immune deficiency syndrome, and we're talking about a virus whose acronym is HIV. You see, what most of these scientists have not recognized is the truly amazing healing powers of a healthy human organism. Of course, they have been making sure that we stay unhealthy for centuries by poisoning us, mostly via our foods and medicine, and that would be a great show on its own. Maybe someday I'll get to that. But understand that the picture is not so bleak. Your health is not at all outside of your own control. In fact, the reality is that only you can take the steps which will ensure that you will be able to remain healthy. Now, in fact, we are drowning in a mire of disinformation regarding diseases that are allegedly afflicting the human race. I hope you all agree that I have managed to at least give you some doubt regarding the historical presentation that has been handed down to us regarding vaccines and the germ theory. And this is all building up to something, folks, because tomorrow's show, I will be talking about AIDS. My first installment on AIDS, and there'll be another show about that, because it is a big one. This is an issue that I am absolutely outraged by. And if you had seen what I have seen over the last 10 years, you would understand why I am so outraged with AIDS. The time is ripe for the truth to come out about this scam called AIDS. And if you tune in tomorrow night, I'll begin the first of the two-part series I've taped here for Bill about it. We're going to show you how AIDS is not a gay or even a sexually transmitted disease. Show you it's not a new disease, show you it's not a worldwide epidemic, show you it's not caused by HIV or any other germ. It's not diagnosable by any lab test, and it's not increasing in black women and children. And we're definitely going to show you that it's not responsive to any vaccine, and most certainly cannot be dealt with by poisonous, toxic chemotherapies like AZT and the like. Folks, right now, where we are today, most people dying of AIDS are dying from treatment, but we'll get into that tomorrow. This is an issue that is going to affect you whether you like it or not, whether it be through the issue of mandatory AIDS testing, through AIDS vaccinations, and the like. I hope you will tune in. I think what I've accumulated over the last few years is valuable. I've put it together, and I have the research of some of the top scientists and researchers that I know of in this world with integrity behind me. I hope you will tune in. If you want to correspond with me about anything I've mentioned on any of the shows I've done, please feel free. I love the exchange of information, and I want to get as much of what I have out to people as possible. My address, Alex Loglia, L-O-G-L-I-A, 217 East 85th Street, Suite 246. New York, New York, 10028. That's Alex Loglia, L-O-G-L-I-A, 217, East 85th Street, Suite 246, New York, New York, 10028. If you'd like, you can include a phone number, and I will get in touch with you by phone. Good night, folks. Take care, and I hope you will tune in tomorrow. Folks, we're back again, third installment on a little series I'm doing here on germ theory and AIDS. Tonight's topic, we are going to begin with AIDS. Now, you even mention this word today and people get scared. Well, fear not, folks. Hopefully, after hearing tonight's show, you will be a lot less scared. And I'll have saved you a lot of trouble, a lot of anguish, a lot of fear related to this hoax called AIDS. I'm going to draw heavily tonight again from the works of Dr. Bill Holub, who has been telling America basically since 1984 that AIDS is not at all what it seems. His work, his seminal work on AIDS, a compendium that's about 50, 60 pages, has about 400 or 500 references in it. In fact, even more than that. It's one of the most well-documented pieces of scholarship I've ever seen, and I'm not going to bother to read you all those references, but I am going to read you some excerpts from that piece of work, because after hearing it, I am sure you will change your opinion on this disease, this alleged disease called AIDS. I'm reading from the work of Dr. Bill Holub. Multifactorial damage, not HIV. The percent of people theoretically exposed to the virus who subsequently develop AIDS is very small. It is about 1%. This fact and many other pieces of information strongly support the role of many cofactors contributing to immune suppression. With the immense number of cofactors already indicated, it is clear that AIDS cannot possibly be caused by HIV. However, the cofactor scenario cannot make as large profits for the medical pharmaceutical complex as does the HIV hypothesis, because their formula is HIV, medication, and death. Now, folks, cofactor simply refers to cofactors, other things involved in producing acquired immune deficiency syndrome outside of the virus. Thus, susceptibility, as defined as poor health, is the major factor in AIDS and not microbes. In a well-referenced work by Drs. Patrick Donovan and Herb Joyner-Bay, many obvious documented susceptibility factors are described, including many concurrent infections, antibiotic use, malnutrition, food tolerance, malabsorption syndrome, stress, smoking, and in parentheses, we see that Philip Morris is increasing the marketing of Marlboros to the gay community, lack of sleep and exercise, etc. This cofactor concept is supported by many in the area of AIDS research. For example, receiving any blood products, transfusions, protein factors, allergy shots, gamma globulin shots, protein hormones, etc., are specifically and dramatically immunosuppressive. Actually, immunosuppression is a synonym for poor health. While we cannot go into this in depth here, you must understand that the immune system is poorly understood by many in the healthcare field. The immune system is not a system, and it does not fight the bad guys, germs, cancer cells, etc. The immune system is actually a group of cells, white blood cells, and their associated organs, circulatory, lymphatic, and other systems. The actual job of the white blood cell is not the exciting, romantic, Pentagon-like soldier function of fighting the enemy, as I had told you in one of the previous shows, folks, but is rather the boring, necessary job of building and maintaining your body. Thus, white cells are far more like janitors than a SWAT team. In the case of AIDS, you can discount another word as not accurately describing what is happening. We have established that AIDS is not acquired, and now we can tell you that AIDS is not an immunodeficiency, at least not until modern medicine treats it. The person diagnosed with AIDS actually has a hyperactive and competent immune system. Their immune system is very capable of producing all the necessary healing reactions, such as fever, swollen lymph nodes, high antibody titers, etc. These are all indications of an active immune system cleaning up toxic damage. Now, remember what I mentioned on the last shows in the germ theory, folks. The disease is the cure. What modern medicine has labeled disease is your body in the process of eliminating toxins. And this is exactly what Bill Holub is saying in reference to AIDS. These are all indications of an active immune system cleaning up toxic damage. When medicine, quote-unquote, treats that person, and or if that person continues a toxic, self-damaging lifestyle, then their health and their ability to heal is what actually becomes deficient. They are actually deficient in good health advice, something you unfortunately cannot get from modern medicine. AIDS is not transmitted. Of course, AIDS was claimed to be sexually transmitted. If you claim that a disease is specific to a certain sexual lifestyle, then you are saying that it is sexually transmitted. If one accused gays of having this quote-unquote new disease, then it was a gay sex that caused the disease. One of their proofs was that the men with AIDS had 1,100 sexual partners per lifetime, about 10 to 15 years, and their control group without AIDS had 500 sexual partners per lifetime. Therefore, sexual promiscuity caused the transmission of the disease, allegedly. But you have to ask an obvious question. If anyone sought out homosexual or heterosexual relationships in such numbers, averaging two different ones per week, and if each encounter involved drugs and medications, then they are obviously not having nourishing sex and do not have a healthy lifestyle. Having a malnourishing lifestyle has nothing to do with sexual preferences. Anyone can have a malnourishing lifestyle. All you have to do, and this is the consistent history in all AIDS persons,
is eat poorly, use drugs, medications, have unloving, malnourishing sex, be medically treated for chronic ailments, have poor emotional, spiritual inputs, etc. So it's not the number of sexual partners you have, but rather how nourishing is your sex life. Remember that food and sex are the core of human nature, and both are necessary inputs for human health. In a Good Review article, a very astute gay observed that a very homophobic culture created, quote, a disease for which supposedly the cure is to go back to all the styles that were preached at us in the first place. Another offered proof was that anal sex was a factor, because sperm pumped into a rabbit's anus, which was an unnecessarily and horrible experiment, caused antibodies in their blood, and that could suppress immunity. Now, this typical example of bad science was, of course, poorly designed, with absolutely no controls, and I will have you know, ladies and gentlemen, that recent searches for HIV-1 in semen have proved absolutely fruitless. That's right, they cannot find HIV-1 in semen. Another supposed proof showed that a large percent of homosexuals showed antibodies to the alleged AIDS virus when anal intercourse was practiced. Now, once again, the bad science indicated in this report showed many other differences between the groups which could explain the disparity, and no controls were run. In any case, other studies showed no antibodies to sperm in AIDS patients and no correlation between promiscuity and positive AIDS antibodies. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you remember the little piece I read you from Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park a couple of shows ago, because you're going to come to find, if you take the time to research the actual studies that have been done on AIDS, that there are a bunch of maybe well-intentioned scientists out there, maybe not, doing experiments to prove things that they want to prove and not doing objective science. And that's going to become more and more clear to you as I read on tonight. Getting back to Bill Hollum. Sexual transmission of AIDS has not been proven. Condoms have a relatively high rate of failure for preventing pregnancy, for which they were designed. And even if the virus was involved, condoms could not prevent transmission. And that's a fact you can check out in any of the research. They have already shown that the so-called AIDS virus exists in all body fluids, so they would have to outlaw all human contact. Now, it's common clinical knowledge when someone has suppressed immunity that all sorts of microorganisms and germs will grow on them. But they are not the cause, but rather they are the consequence of immune depression. Believe it or not, they are there to help you. The issue over whether germs are causes or consequences of disease is very lengthy. We feel that germs are a consequence of the single disease called malnourishment, and that they are more likely to be trying to participate in repair and regeneration of the host than in killing or harming the host. In any case, AIDS has a plethora of germs involved, and any one or more of them could be equally labeled the cause. Any germ would have sufficed as the, quote, cause of AIDS, but a new disease requires a new germ for new research money, and that is the crux of what we're talking about here, ladies and gentlemen. Thus, the 35 or so equally qualified germ candidates were passed over as a hunt for a new germ was and is subsidized. Opportunistic germs are supposedly those germs that proliferate in order to take over a host during an illness. Then, all germs could easily be considered opportunistic, including the AIDS virus. The alleged specificity of the HIV-1 infecting T cells and causing a decrease in helper suppressor T cells is also true for almost every other germ. Now, folks, if you ever have even come across anybody doing AIDS testing, the first thing they do is they give you an antibody test. And the next thing they do is give you a T-cell count. Now listen to what we're saying here, folks. All the research that we are showing here that has come across me and that has come across through the work that Bill Hollab has done, any germ, practically, will show a T-cell decrease. That is true for most germs. A low T-cell count, which is one of the corollary symptoms that we find for AIDS, is nonsense. It can be caused by almost anything. Now, remember that many germs could do all the same things that are claimed for the so-called AIDS virus. They are the result and not the cause, according to the logic of Sutton's law. And let's remember, when Willie Sutton, the famous bank robber, was asked why he robbed banks, he replied, because that's where the money is. Quote, sick germs grow in sick people because that's where the ideal environment is. Now remember what I said about germs over the last couple of shows. Well germs grow in well people because that's where their ideal environment is. We change germs from well to sick. They do not change us. The dog wags the tail does not wag the dog. One wonders why the name of the alleged AIDS virus has undergone so many name changes. HIV-1 was known as HTLV-3, human T-cell leukemia virus, and its LAV, lymphadenopathy-associated virus, and was probably renamed because the American and French scientists continue to squabble over who, quote, owns the cause of AIDS. Because remember, there is great profit in owning this virus, as the great Gallo scandal has pointed out. To date, there is no evidence that the HIV-1 plays any role in the cause of AIDS. HIV-1 is found everywhere in the body. It has been found almost everywhere in the world. Its rate of infectivity is less than 1%. It has been around well before 1980 and may have been around for centuries or more. And remember that we all make our own viruses. Why has this one been picked upon as the alleged cause of AIDS? Retroviruses, of which HIV is a member, were very popular subjects for research and research grants during the early 80s. They have been trying to implicate them in some human cancers, and there certainly is money available for cancer research. The data, however, shows the retroviruses to be opportunistic, as are the other germs listed in Figure 15, and I'm going to read Figure 15 for you later. Certain viruses often appear in very sick people and are not specific in any disease association. HIV-1 seems to be in cells everywhere in the body, blood, brain, spinal fluid, saliva, tears, etc. Thus, it is not T-cell specific, as was originally claimed. Now remember, folks, they're trying to tell you that HIV goes into your T-cells and knocks out your immune system through your T-cells, and that is a bold-faced lie. HIV not only appears to be everywhere in the world, but appears to be totally different in different locations and to be a whole spectrum of different viruses. In fact, the more you look, the more variants you find. Not surprising, since different people make different viruses. In a totally no-risk group of Aboriginal Indians from Venezuela with almost no contact with civilizations, HIV was found, not only widening its occurrence, but suggesting that this virus has been around for hundreds and perhaps thousands of years. The only correlating factor in this tribe was the association with malaria, which is also an immunosuppressive illness. Again, it appears that HIV only appears in sick people and does not cause them to be sick. Constantly, throughout much of the literature, it has been suggested that other factors, quote-unquote, play a role in AIDS. But these admonitions seem to be ignored as the money and technology in medicine gears up for another decade of HIV testing, HIV drugs, and HIV vaccines, even though there is no scientific evidence that these avenues will be worthwhile. Now remember, folks, practically every report I have seen from the CDC and from the National Institute of Health tell you that AIDS has no cure, and yet in the same breath they will tell you that drugs like AZT, DDL, and other things are effective. I hope you will take the time to check out the research, because you will get a good laugh one day. Viruses are not alive and are made by us. One should understand that the search for viruses is not an easy task. They cannot be seen or in any way be directly shown to exist in any sample of human tissue. For this reason, virtually all viral research is dependent upon coaxing viruses to be made by cells in grossly abnormal tissue cultures. None of these findings or results can actually be extrapolated to processes involved in human health or disease. In fact, all tissue culture-derived data, while perhaps interesting, has absolutely no valid application in the study of health or human disease. It is most likely, as with most germs grown on artificial media, that viruses isolated and blamed for AIDS do not even exist in the humans with the syndrome. In fact, they are most likely artifacts of the involved process of repeated transfers of material from various tumor cells grown in synthetic environment using synthetic nutrients. Any good microbiologist or virologist would tell you that germs identified by tissue culture techniques bear little resemblance to the original tissue plus germs sampled. So, folks, we're saying that when we are isolating viruses for AIDS research, we are not looking at the actual thing that is in the human beings. And this is something that I know because I have been in the field of microbiology, and I know this. The stuff that we're saying about AIDS here in this particular case is absolutely true because it is backed by a lot of data, but it's unfortunately data that you do not read about in the Times. The comment about the quote-unquote long-term incubation of HIV also proves that the virus has always been with us and only proliferates when a person becomes ill. If you get a cold today, does that mean that you actually caught the cold virus last week, last year, or 50 years ago? Germs don't incubate. They are always there and only awaiting a situation in which they are needed. After 7 years of waiting, only 133 cases of AIDS have been shown out of 13,000 reported alleged infected heterosexual transfers. Does that sound like a high infectivity or incubation period? The recent false report published in April of 93 of those little HIVs busy inside lymph nodes is complete nonsense, because that is where most of your lymphocytes hang out, and that's where you would expect to find the HIV healing message. A very wise doctor admitted that medicine is still not sure of the role of the virus that is involved in AIDS, and that they should not use any treatment experimentally. He said, quote, "Initial enthusiasm over any new treatment should not obscure the need for considered evaluation over time. The triumph of enthusiasm over time produced the only Nobel Prize ever offered in psychiatry in 1949 for the frontal lobotomy." What about the monkey AIDS called STAIDS? Well, they have been trying to blame the African monkey as well as the people of Africa for starting this supposed epidemic, but there is no proof except that sick monkeys can get similar viruses to appear. Now, finally, to totally dispute any role for HIV and AIDS, the following list sums up all the scientific evidence against the AIDS-HIV hypothesis. These points were gleaned from the works of Dr. Duesberg, that's Dr. Peter Duesberg, folks, who published an extensive review with 278 references, also from Dr. Jonas, Dr. Ruth Bernstein, and many others, all of which clearly showed why HIV could not possibly be responsible for AIDS, as the group for scientific investigation of the AIDS-HIV hypothesis has been saying for years. I'm going to start reading this list, folks. You are going to like it. I have referenced every single thing I'm about to read here. It is true, it is fact, and I hope you will pay very close attention. 1. 97% of U.S. AIDS cases come from abnormal risk groups, i.e., IV drug abusers, male homosexuals who use toxic drugs, hemophiliacs, crack babies and crack mothers, recipients of blood products, etc. Healthy people with normal health risk do not get AIDS. 2. Less than 5% of AIDS patients with symptoms are carriers of HIV. Evidence of HIV is not found in all AIDS cases. According to the CDC, you can have AIDS without any evidence of HIV. That's like being convicted of murder with no evidence being required. Folks, I hope you heard this. The CDC says that you can have AIDS without HIV, and yet millions and millions of dollars are being made out there to test people for HIV and give them a death sentence and drive them to the grave just from the weight and the heavy pressure of carrying around a HIV-positive test. But remember, I just told you that the CDC itself will tell you that AIDS does not mean you will have the HIV virus in you. And that's true, because right now there are more than 5,000 cases, diagnosed cases of AIDS, allegedly, 5,000 people walking around the United States who have been told they have AIDS, who have been clinically shown to have AIDS, according to the modern medical establishment, and yet who have not one single trace of the HIV virus. Think about that, folks. Think about that very carefully. Number three, HIV would have to produce all of its symptoms in a few days to a few weeks. HIV has no genes to enable it to incubate for the alleged 10 or more years. Four, 91% of all AIDS victims are males. If sex transmission were actually occurring, then females should have the same rate of AIDS. Both pregnancy and other sexually transmitted diseases have been on the rise for the past 10 years. So women should be at least half of the AIDS cases, but they are not. 5. AIDS is equal to about 50 other diseases in its pathology and in its symptomology. Yet many of these diseases are not induced by immune deficiency. And we're talking about Kaposi sarcoma, lymphomas, wasting disease, dementia, and autoimmune illnesses. Nor are these diseases caused by microbes. And yet, the symptomology, the description of symptoms, which they call AIDS, is identical to these diseases, which, on the other hand, do not have any link to any microbes or any germ infection. 6. Most HIV-positive people remain healthy for 10 years and probably will live much longer. 7. Another interesting fact. Many Kaposi sarcoma and pneumocystis carinii pneumonia patients have no HIV in them. 8. The HIV-positive American male homosexuals have 20 times the risk of Kaposi sarcoma than all other risk groups. This suggests additional toxic factors. Okay, folks, we're going to take a break here. Let Bill take his break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Okay, back to this amazing little list. Number 9, even when dying of AIDS, the HIV test can be negative. And since HIV is present in about 1 of every 10,000 T-cells, why are T-cells still disappearing even after HIV is gone? 10. Since you produce antibodies to HIV, how could you get sick after establishing your immunity? Many have classic immunity with antibodies and no HIV. Now, understand this, ladies and gentlemen. This is one of my favorites. We have set up most of the current AIDS tests to test for the antibody. Now, usually, if you know any basic biology, when you have an antibody, it means your body is already fighting the disease. So, when we are shown to have antibodies to HIV, how could you get sick after having established your immunity? It's the same scam as we talked about with vaccines. Now, again, let me read this part. Many people have classic immunity with antibodies and no HIV. Now, think about that. 11. Chimpanzees and accidentally inoculated healthcare workers, some 20,000, have not developed AIDS. Folks, that's documented fact. I'll bet you didn't know that. 12. Why are there significant geographical differences? In Europe and the U.S., most cases are homosexuals. In Africa and South America, most cases are heterosexual. How does the HIV know what sexual preference people have? How could the alleged modes of transmission be so widely different from culture to culture? 13. Also, people in different risk groups and different countries get different symptoms. In the U.S., we see pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, Kaposi sarcoma, and candidiasis. In Africa, we see Slim disease, fever, diarrhea, and TB, even though pneumocystis carinii pneumonia and candida is found in all people. 14. Cannot isolate the virus in 20 to 50% of AIDS diagnosed people. Now, isn't that interesting? Think about that, folks. Think about what modern medicine tells you. They tell you if you have the disease, you must have the germ, and we're telling you right here, according to referenced scientific research, that 20 to 50% of the AIDS cases are there, but you cannot isolate the virus in them. You figure it out. 15. Retroviruses like HIV do not kill T cells. In fact, they promote cell growth and proliferation of T cells. Even in tissue culture, T cells can produce prodigious numbers of HIV, far more than possible in any AIDS patient, and the T cells are never harmed. Let me read that to you again, because you have been told that AIDS is out there destroying your T lymphocytes. That it's the crux of what AIDS is doing, and that's why you develop some kind of alleged immune suppression. Listen. Retroviruses like HIV do not kill T cells. In fact, they promote cell growth and proliferation of T cells. Even in tissue culture, T cells can produce prodigious numbers of HIV, and the T cells are never harmed. 16. There are no AIDS cases where HIV presence is the only immunosuppressive factor. In fact, all AIDS cases have one or more known causes of immunodeficiency, including exposure to blood transfusions, excessive exposure to semen, excessive use of addictive recreational drugs, chronic or high doses of antibiotics, antivirals, antiparasitic agents, anti-inflammatories, anesthetics, opiate analgesics, antidepressants, surgical trauma, injury trauma, multiple recurrent viral diagnoses, malnutrition, lymphocytotoxic autoimmunity, etc. 17. Some HIV-negative people in risk groups are more immunosuppressive and sick than HIV-positive individuals in the matched group, with correlations to immunosuppressive factors. So, folks, the correlation with the symptoms listed under the umbrella of acquired immune deficiency syndrome are more correlated to these risk factors that I just read a few seconds ago than to the HIV virus. 18. Prior immunosuppression needs to be present to lead to HIV positive, meaning that an unhealthy state is a prerequisite, what used to be called lack of resistance or increased susceptibility. 19. Many cases of AIDS, by all criteria of the CDC, are HIV negative. That's my favorite. I hope you'll think about that one carefully, folks. 20. HIV is supposed to be new, but many confirmed clinical cases can be identified going back to the 19th century and earlier to the 16th century. 21. Female prostitutes who are drug abusers have a high incidence of HIV-positive diagnoses, yet prostitutes who are not drug abusers show almost zero incidence of HIV-positive, indicating non-sexually transmitted factors. Over 85% of all AIDS cases involve drug abuse. Now, folks, that doesn't just mean it's from people injecting and it's spread by the blood, because I've already shown you that that's nonsense. The drug abuse is the key. That is an immunosuppressive factor. Remember, germs don't cause disease. The disease causes germs. 22. You can find HIV in only about 10 to 30% of HIV-positive gay men. So how could it be transmitted by sperm, as once alleged? 23. Many people revert from HIV-positive to HIV-negative and remain healthy. And this again suggests other multiple factors. I'll bet you didn't know that, folks. Well, I know some of these people personally. 24. Every AIDS case shows positive tests for autoimmune reactions, indicating significant tissue breakdown caused by toxic and malnourishing exposures. Symptoms correlate with chronic autoimmune diseases, not infectious diseases. Symptoms correlate with chronic autoimmune diseases, not infectious diseases. Now, what this means, folks, is that AIDS is not an infectious disease. It is something, an umbrella of symptoms that correlate highly with a number of different factors that are linked to immunosuppression. But it has nothing to do with HIV, and it has nothing to do with an infectious disease that is, quote-unquote, spread. 25. There exist more than 800 HIV-negative immunodeficiencies and AIDS-defining diseases in all major American and European AIDS risk groups. And 2,200 HIV-negative African AIDS cases that meet all the World Health Organization's criteria for diagnosis of AIDS. These are the recently described mystery AIDS cases explained. I hope you will think about that. I hope you're getting this on tape, because I know some of this is hard to grasp the first time. 26. Only about 50% of AIDS cases as reported by the Center for Disease Control are confirmed HIV positive. Much of the remainder may be HIV negative. And I know why Bill Holler wrote this way, because in my own efforts to decipher and get AIDS research data from the CDC, you will find that they do not publish any of their data, any of their results. They publish you conclusions. Anything the CDC puts out about AIDS would never be accepted even into the most lax scientific journals. Think about that, folks. 27. HIV violates infectious disease rules used for over a century, which are Koch's postulates. Because no viral traces can be found in many AIDS patients, and one of the basic tenets of Koch's postulate is that if you have the disease, you must have the germ. And that is simply not the case in AIDS, and, believe it or not, not the case in almost every example of alleged infectious diseases. 28. HIV isolation is completely artificial, and it bears no resemblance to the systems of a living human being. You cannot even find the virus in most AIDS cases. 29. HIV infects a very small number of T cells, which is about 1 in 10,000, and it has no capacity to destroy any of them. They would be replaced faster than they would be lost. Retroviruses are not cytosidal, which means they do not kill cells, and they actually promote cell growth. Now remember, everyone out there is telling you that AIDS is a retrovirus, and it is killing your T lymphocytes, and that's why you get suppressed immunity. Well, it's all nonsense. 30. There are two viruses claimed to cause AIDS, HIV-1 and HIV-2, which have a 60% different structure. Rapid evolution of multiple viruses causing the same disease are highly, highly improbable. These works and others cast serious doubt on whether HIV can indeed kill lymphocytes and suppress immunity. Yet almost everyone in America believes that HIV is the cause of AIDS. Why? It is a simple use of propaganda phrases, slogans, and the media. As in Hitler's Germany, it was realized that if you repeat a lie loud and often enough, people will eventually believe it. This is what has happened in America today, and it is called advertising or brainwashing. So if you keep listening to the mass media, you will chant HIV equals AIDS over and over in your mind, like Winston tastes good, like a cigarette should, along with many other slogans. There is an interesting alternate hypothesis for viral action in disease states. It is very possible that viruses play an intercellular communicative role in the repair and regeneration of damaged tissues in the human being. It seems that a large section of the HIV virus's external envelope is almost identical to a substance naturally occurring in our bodies. This substance is called neuroleukin, and it is one of many cytokines like interferon, interleukin, etc., factors which are involved in the repair of damaged nerve cells and other tissues. Do you really think that this is all a coincidence? We make all viruses, ladies and gentlemen. There are much more active viruses associated with AIDS. For example, cytomegalovirus and Epstein-Barr, which are both present in over 95% of AIDS patients, contribute to virulent pneumonias. Folks, the AIDS label can be applied to any individual who has any acute or even asymptomatic infection, any persistent swelling of lymph glands, any chronic constitutional illness, any neurologic pathology, any secondary infection, any secondary cancer, and other things, with or without a confirmatory test. In general, 40 to 60% stated causes of death are largely incorrect, based upon the most accurate form of diagnosis, the autopsy. With all causes of death being so poorly identified by physicians, imagine the error rate in the diagnosis of AIDS. Accumulating evidence suggests that AIDS is essentially a new name being applied to a wide variety of old illnesses, and that the so-called AIDS or HIV tests may be no more than tests for any chronic illness. Both the diagnostic criteria and several laboratory tests that are supposedly specific for AIDS have shown very close correlations, to hypogammaglobulin anemia, post-bone marrow transplant reactions, lupus, carcinoid tumors, neurologic pathology related to nutritional deficiencies, myasthenia gravis, multiple sclerosis, tuberculosis, malaria, leukemia, and 35 other common infections, all autoimmune diseases, such as lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, Graves' disease, thyroiditis, and other diseases, including 100 other descriptions. Now, what does this all mean? It means that most of the AIDS tests out there don't test for acquired immune deficiency syndrome. They test for an antibody to this virus, which has been shown by almost every piece of research out there, does not cause anything called AIDS. So, folks, if you are ever coaxed into taking an HIV test, please do not do it. They are inaccurate. HIV does not cause what we are calling AIDS in the first place. And most of the tests out there will test positive for a number of other diseases. Understand this well. This is documented fact. And if you leave here with anything tonight, I hope you will leave with the understanding that you should not get any AIDS test. It is nonsense. It is absolutely absurd. And you will be asking for trouble, as you will see in the next few minutes. In the early days of AIDS, one claimed diagnostic test was the decrease in helper suppressor T cells. This test could not verify AIDS because almost all infection caused these same results. Later, it was shown that this decrease in helper suppressor cells occurs with equal frequency in homosexuals who do not test positive for AIDS. Thus, the test is not specific for AIDS, only for any general illness. It also has no prognostic value and does not mean one has suppressed immunity. Other tests that appear told the same story. Thymosin alpha 1, neopterin, beta microglobulin, energy, CD4, etc., all claim to be surrogate markers for AIDS, but all have been subsequently shown to be positive in most chronic illnesses. The many generations of currently available tests are fraught with major problems, making them all useless and dangerous. A partial list of severe problems associated with AIDS testing follows. 1. The tests have a very large false positive rate, falsely identifying a patient as having AIDS when in fact they do not. This percentage rate ranges from 40 to 500%. With many false positives in women. The ability to accurately identify the syndrome is usually less than 20%. Today's tests suffer from a 97 to 99% false positive rate in no-risk screening applications. Swallow that, folks. Believe it, it is true, it is fact, I have verified it. 2. The tests are positive in many cases of alcoholism, malaria, and any autoimmune disease, including arthritis and 200 other illnesses. 3. The test will show false positives if the blood sample is heated, frozen, stored for a long time, or not allowed to fully clot. In fact, 95% who test positive have absolutely no virus present. I hope you are all getting pissed off out there, folks, and I hope if any of you out there have ever gotten any kind of HIV test that you are fuming right now because you have been totally fooled. 4. The supposedly more specific virus tests, which are more expensive, less sensitive, and more prone to lab error, hence have large false positives and false negative rates. Now, even one of the most accepted tests that's supposed to be confirmatory for the HIV virus, the Western blot, sure, it'll tell you in certain low percentages of cases when that virus is present. But folks, I think from what I have read up until today and in today, you will have at least a doubt as to whether HIV even causes AIDS. I know it does not. I hope you have a doubt in your mind, and I hope you will go out and verify this for yourself. Get it, folks. Get it in your heads. HIV testing is a scam. HIV does not cause AIDS. The tests are totally inaccurate and have incredibly high false positive and false negative rates. There's a little section here that Bill Holub did showing
that if HIV is present in about 1 per 1,000 people, and it's nowhere near this, by the way, and let's say that a test claims 98% reliability to identify the HIV virus, and again, there's not one test that is this high, this means that the test misses 2% of HIV-positive people and falsely identifies 2% as having HIV-positive. Now, you take this test. What is the probability of it correctly identifying HIV in you? Did you say 98%? Well, you are dead wrong. The correct answer is 4.7%. So you have a 4.7% chance of being identified as HIV positive correctly and a 95.3% chance of being falsely identified as being HIV positive. And he goes into explaining it. I won't go into it now, but it's all very correctly done statistically. I hope you will leave this show tonight with the understanding that you do not need any kind of HIV testing, that what we are calling AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, is not acquired, it is not an immune deficiency, and it has nothing to do with that damn virus that they are calling HIV. I'm going to have to start to wind down here and continue on this train of thought in the next show, tomorrow night show. Let me read you from one of my favorite articles that I picked out of the New York Times, the national circulation issue, Friday, October 9th, 1992. It's a very interesting article because it appears with a wrong headline. It's actually under the title, New Tool for Detecting Dark Matter, and it talks about stuff going out in the universe. But it opens as follows. Scientists have found 5 people who were infected with the virus that causes AIDS by blood transfusion from one donor and then did not develop any evidence of illness 7 to 10 years later. Now, the normal person would think, that would mean that AIDS, or rather HIV, does not cause AIDS. But you know what the genius who wrote this article wrote? This suggests that it was a non-virulent strain. Now, I'm not going to read the rest of the article because it's a bunch of nonsense, but you can get an idea of what kind of purposely created stupidity there is out there regarding this disease. And you read it in the Times and you believe it. Burns me, folks. Really burns me. Folks, this is just a start. Tomorrow night's show, I'm going to bring you up into the present moment with information relating to what is really going on in Africa, what is going on with the alleged cases of women developing AIDS and the cases of children. And I am going to read you excerpts from 2 of the most important nationally published articles that I have yet found on the subject, and you are going to be floored. Because if you did not believe little old me telling you what I have been telling you for the last couple of shows, you will hear information tomorrow that is going to blow your mind, that is right out of some of the top people in the scientific community and published in national magazines. But I'm sure if you weren't keeping your eyes open that you did not find this stuff, and it happened very recently. Well, folks, I hope you will join us tomorrow. Tomorrow will be a very important show. It's important to me. I want you to get the word out that you do not have to be scared by this alleged acquired immune deficiency syndrome stuff. I don't want you to leave this show confused. I want you to have a very clear understanding in your mind. HIV does not cause AIDS. There is no bug out there creating this disease. People are going to be dying. Part of the plan, they're going to blame AIDS, they're going to blame HIV, but that is to cover the truth. And hopefully in a future show, I am going to tell you exactly how your food, your air, and your water is being poisoned, and that is where you are developing these diseases. I already told you about inoculations, that's one part, but there's a lot more. Tune in tomorrow, though, folks, to get the last word on AIDS. I hope you'll be there. Again, if you want to hear anything, or rather, if you want to get anything from me, research information, point you in the right direction for finding sources, you want to argue with me by the mail, please feel free to do so. You can write to me, Alex Loglia, L-O-G-L-I-A, 217 East 85th Street, Suite 246, New York, New York, 10028. Take care, folks. Good night, and I hope we'll have you listening in tomorrow. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm back again tonight for my last installment on the subject of acquired immune deficiency syndrome. I've covered a lot of ground over the last couple of nights, both with the germ theory and with AIDS. And tonight, I want to bring this all to a head to get some points across to you that are very important to me. I'm going to read you a little bit more from Bill Holub's work and quote you some articles that are going to be supporting what I'm saying here. I did back on show before last tell you that I was going to tell you about Africa, about AIDS cases in women and children. So, here we go. This is from Bill Holub, who I've mentioned enough for you to know already. The evidence is overwhelming that a major factor in AIDS is chronic malnutrition, yet this is selectively ignored by the media and the medical community. Figure 22, which is some picture here, you see, describes the major clinical features of AIDS, which also happen to be the exact same list of the major clinical features of classic protein-calorie malnutrition, whose acronym is PCM, which is the only major disease process occurring in the underdeveloped countries and in the homeless starving people of America. Actually, the U.S. now qualifies as a socially undeveloped and over-medicated country. It is astonishing to note that all the symptoms of AIDS are identical to the symptoms of classic protein-calorie malnutrition. With regard to transfusions, the situation is similar. Transfusions like immunizations or the introduction into the body of foreign proteins is a very potent immune challenge. If this immune challenge is given to someone ill, malnourished, etc., then rapid immunosuppression follows, and remember what I told you in my show about vaccinations. Thus, the chronic infection seen after transfusion, as is the subsequent immune depression, and the AIDS-like syndrome are due to other clinical factors and not to the HIV/AIDS virus. Now, reading on, women, as 50% of the consumers, need to be duped into the AIDS myth. The first few cases were described in women who were called, quote, previously healthy, and yet if you looked at their clinical history, you wondered what previously healthy means. These women had long histories of drug abuse, chronic infections, anemia. In other words, they were frequently sick and frequently medicated, and that is how they developed the symptoms called AIDS. The media continues to whip up paranoia, fear, prejudice, and vengeful anger into the public maelstrom of AIDS. There is the classic story of the two women who received transfusions who were later told that they would get AIDS and die. One stayed well, and medicine termed her lucky. The other got sick, and they termed her AIDS. What would happen to you if you were told, and you believed it, that you were going to die and to keep coming back to the hospital for tests and treatments for years while you and medicine wait for the signs of the deadly disease? Most people would probably get very sick under such stress. There was also a sad testimonial to the media when a foster mother let her son die because she was afraid that he got AIDS in the hospital. children victimized by the AIDS medical machine. In children, AIDS is detected and treated the same way as it is in adults, so the outcome is the same. But the percent supposedly infected that go on to get AIDS is very small, so again, other factors have been suggested. In these children, the quote-unquote therapy is just as aggressive and just as lethal. About 90% of supposed maternal transmissions of AIDS can be accounted for because the women are usually drug abusers and were very sick and very medicated before and after birth. Remember, whatever a pregnant woman does to herself and whatever medicine does to her is also done to the unborn baby. So is this really showing transmission of disease or simply continued toxic care? Folks, in one study, children with AIDS showed the following associations when compared to a group without AIDS. 200% more injections, 31% more transfusions, 60% more surgery, 96% more vaccinations, 59% longer hospital stays, and 31% more transfusions. Folks, this is the correlative data, meaning that the children who had AIDS had these cofactors. Thus, it seems that the more treatment you get, the more likely you are to get sick and to be labeled as having AIDS. The media has put false fear into the public by saying that breastfeeding transmits AIDS, even though the one quoted case had no evidence to show of any transmission. We presume that the infant formula companies will love this propaganda. Now, an unusual exchange occurred in the medical literature recently in which American medical people keep insisting that Africa was the source of the AIDS virus, while African scientists could not substantiate this claim. There was no evidence of any significant positive tests, and the tests which did show positive had a high correlation to previously mentioned protein-calorie malnutrition, malaria, Burkitt's lymphoma, and other diseases of chronic malnutrition. These correlations are sufficient to explain the high rate of false positives. Much misinformation and disinformation has been reported about AIDS in Africa. Following a six-week tour of 26 cities and towns in 16 sub-Saharan countries, physician Felix Kote Ahulu of the Cromwell Hospital, London, observed that press statements were grossly exaggerated. He found, quote, "Uppermost in the minds of intelligent Africans and Europeans was the question, why do the world's media appear to have conspired with some scientists to become so gratuitously extravagant with the untruth? This journalistic hyperbole has proved very expensive. Africans overseas have experienced racial abuse, tourism has unjustly suffered, and tension seems to have developed between white doctors working in Africa. Many whites with a fund of goodwill for Africa feel even more strongly than I do about the effect of the world's media on that continent. Africa's only really endemic diseases are malnutrition, environmental degradation, social political wars, poverty, poor hygiene, and unhealthy sexual practices. Africa has the highest percent of the population suffering from chronic malnutrition. That is about 168 million people, which is 33% compared to the Far East of 19%, Latin America 13%, and the Near East 12%. Of course, if our government were honest with us, our country would be right up there with the worst. The black African prejudice concerning AIDS may be shifting to the black American as race becomes an issue. Witness a report claiming to find new abnormal facial features in children born to mothers tested positive for AIDS. The report was subsequently shown to be false because the investigators did not realize that features such as flat nasal bridge, prominent forehead, prominent lips, and slanted eyes are observed with a certain degree of frequency in normal black and Hispanic children and could hardly be considered abnormal. Folks, I hope that gives you some idea of what's going on here. The only real reason that we may be seeing AIDS in Africa, aside from what I have just read, is smallpox vaccination programs that were there a while back. Now, some of the more radical people out there will tell you that the smallpox vaccinations were actually either laced with AIDS or were precursors of AIDS, and personally, from the data I've seen, it's nonsense, and from the data I have seen and the work I've done with vaccinations, you do not even need a killer virus to be
put into these vaccines to create these kind of immunosuppressive problems and symptoms. Folks, like I said on my vaccination show, vaccinations alone are enough to produce all the immunosuppressive symptoms in people years after they've received the vaccination. That's fact. I don't know anybody who'll argue that with you after they see the data. Now, also from some of the data that my friend Bill Holub has put together, first-year profits and sales for AIDS tests. Let me just read you the company names and the profits they've made and the first-year sales. Electronucleonics, $56.9 million sales in AIDS tests. Baxter Cavanaugh, $1.8 billion. Abbott Laboratories, $3.1 billion. Centocor, $10.9 million. This is all first-year sales figures for companies that produce AIDS tests. Now, Bill Holub also has some fantastic data, which I can't really go into in detail. But suffice to say, through careful statistical analysis, he has shown dozens of other diseases that have been renamed as AIDS, and shown you the number of lost cases of those diseases that have been renamed as AIDS. I'm looking right at it. It's a little bit too complicated of a chart to read to you. But suffice it to say, folks, the data is here. It has been published. It exists. It is documented. It is very carefully referenced. Some other stuff here that I can read to you, which is interesting. Other disease states of which can now also be renamed or reclassified as AIDS, and this is from data from the Center for Disease Control. Listen to what they are calling AIDS now, folks. Tuberculosis, salmonella, any mycobacterial disease, reticulosarcoma, any malignant lymphoma, any encephalopathy, any dementia, any weight loss, diarrhea, malnutrition, any recurrent or multiple bacterial infections, candidiasis, cryptococcosis, cytomegalovirus disease, herpes simplex disease, Kaposi sarcoma, lymphoma of the brain, lymphoid, interstitial pneumonia, Mycobacterium avium complex. I'm not going to go on. I hope you get the picture. I really hope you get the picture, folks. Let me read a little bit from an article from February 5th Times of this year of 1993. It's titled Epidemic of AIDS in Africa, A Tragic Myth. And then again, it's the London Sunday Times. And this is by Neville Hodgkins. I'm just going to read you some of the stuff I've underlined just for fun. Africa is not in the grip of an AIDS epidemic, and false assertions that the continent is being devastated by HIV are leading to a tragic diversion of resources from genuine medical needs. Some of the heretics even maintain there is no evidence of a new sexually transmitted disease in Africa. Where death rates have increased, they say it is because of civil war, poverty linked to economic decline, and growing use of hard drugs. Professor Peter Duisberg, the University of California virologist, argues that HIV is harmless and does not cause AIDS. According to the World Health Organization, 7.5 million people are infected with HIV in sub-Saharan Africa, and that AIDS will be killing 500,000 people a year there by the end of the century. Dr. Harvey Bialy, a leading American scientist with long experiences in Africa, who accompanied the television crew, says there is absolutely no believable pervasive evidence that Africa is in the midst of a new epidemic of infectious immunodeficiency. Because international funds are available for AIDS and HIV work, politicians and health workers have an incentive to classify people as AIDS sufferers. Folks, I hope this sounds like something I spoke to you about in reference to vaccinations. False diagnosis and renaming of diseases. Quote, fear of AIDS is having almost as great an effect as AIDS itself. People are frightened of going to see a doctor because they believe they will be diagnosed as having AIDS and feel condemned to death. It has become a joke in Uganda that you are not allowed to die of anything but AIDS. Bialy said last week, a favorite story is that a friend has just been run over by a car and doctors put it down as AIDS-related suicide. I heard it from the doorman at our hotel in Kampala.
He was laughing, saying that AIDS was supposed to be sexually transmitted. Yet in his 5 years there, the prostitutes who came to the bar were exactly the same. None of them had become sick. What is new is that these girls are addicted to viciously adulterated smokable heroin and cocaine. And again, Bialy, the scientific editor of Biotechnology, which is a sister publication to the science journal Nature, has been visiting Africa since 1975. He says, the only utterly new phenomenon I have seen is the drug-using prostitutes in Abidjan and the Ivory Coast. He said, these girls come from Ghana, from families of prostitutes who were brought in by the busloads. They've been doing this for generations and never became sick until now. And again, what I just stopped reading is, what is new is that these girls are addicted to viciously adulterated smokable heroin and cocaine. It completely destroys them. They look exactly like the inner-city crack-addicted prostitutes of the United States. Bialy says part of the problem is that HIV testing is frequently misleading in Africa. Well, let me add, it's totally misleading in the United States. He continues, the tests react to antibodies to malaria as well as HIV, producing up to 80% to 90% false positives. There's vast literature showing this, just so you know that I'm not making this up, folks. Most AIDS diagnoses in Africa do not involve an HIV test, but are based on World Health Organization definitions based on clinical signs, including weight loss, chronic diarrhea, and prolonged fever. I just read those to you a few minutes ago from Dr. Bill Holland. A recent study in The Lancet from Japanese doctors working in Ghana reported that out of a group of 227 diagnosed AIDS patients, who had all three of these signs as well as other AIDS-related conditions, 59% showed no trace of HIV in their blood. For the past 7 years, and we're talking about a doctor here, Professor Beverly Griffin, Director of Virology at the Royal Postgraduate Medical School in Hammersmith Hospital. For the past 7 years, she has received blood samples of hundreds of children in Malawi. The proportion that are HIV positive has remained unchanged at 1 to 2%. This casts doubt, she feels, on the claims elsewhere that Malawi is in the grip of an HIV epidemic with about a fifth of its population infected. And again, folks, and let me correct what I said at the beginning of reading. This is not from the New York Times. It's from the March 21st, 1993 issue of the London Sunday Times. I hope this has made some impact on you, and I hope you've heard what I've said here, folks. We're in the midst of a big scam. I want to get right into this because time is of the essence. I am now going to read you excerpts from the article that appeared in this month's actually, no, it's still this month because it's September now that I'm doing this. September issue of Spin Magazine. And we are talking about an interview with Dr. Peter Duesberg with Bob Guccione Jr. in Spin Magazine. I hope you can still go out and get it. And if you can't go out and get it, get the October one because the October issue is just as good. It's got another article that I will be reading from as well. Duesberg's credentials are impeccable. He is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and a recipient of an outstanding investigative grant from the National Institutes of Health in 1985. He was a candidate for the Nobel Prize for his work in discovering oncogenes, thought to be a cause of cancer. But he derailed his chance of winning when he cautioned that his findings did not prove that there were cancer genes in cells, as was popularly theorized at the time, and it is still an unproven theory. An insane move for a scientist's career, but an exemplary act of ethics. Now, Dr. Duesberg, I have been studying his work personally for the last 5 or 6 years. It is impeccable. This man has integrity. He is brave. He is not out there trying to find research money. And here's what he has to say about AIDS in an interview with Bob Guccione Jr. in September's Spin magazine, starting on page 96. Spin. Why do you think HIV doesn't cause AIDS? Duesberg. Every virus I've seen gets its job done by killing a cell at a time, and when it is killed enough, you get sick. HIV is said to be responsible for the loss of T cells, which are the immune system. Now, in every AIDS patient studied so far, there is never more than, on average, 1 in 1,000 cells infected by HIV. How many cells in 1,000 would another virus infect, for instance, a flu virus? If it would cause flu, then 30% of your lung cells are ruined by the virus, the lining is gone or infected. If you have hepatitis, almost every single cell in your liver is infected. Spin. A lot of very bright scientists are working in AIDS, and they don't have all the dubious agendas, and they must have asked themselves the same questions. If HIV doesn't kill a lot of cells, why is it widely believed to be the cause of AIDS? Duesberg, by assigning it all these unprecedented, paradoxical properties that no other virus ever had. They say it can kill cells indirectly or can induce something called autoimmunity, which essentially is the virus sends out a trigger and the body is now convinced to commit suicide. Or they say there are cofactors, if you really press them hard on it. But what they are has yet to be determined. How feasible is the argument that HIV triggers autoimmunity? It is very implausible indeed. There are a million Americans with HIV who are totally healthy. There are 6 million Africans, according to the World Health Organization, who have HIV. 129,000 had AIDS by the end of last year. That means 5,800,000 and so many thousands had no AIDS. 500,000 Europeans have HIV and 60,000 have AIDS. So, there are millions and millions of people on this planet who have HIV but no AIDS. Why don't 7.5 million get autoimmune disease if HIV is the cause of an autoimmune disease? Spin. Well, the establishment says that everybody with HIV will develop AIDS, and it's just a matter of time. In the last 10 years, this is Duesberg, this has happened in America to about 20% of all people with HIV, 250,000, including deaths to date out of a million. But the people who are dying from AIDS are hardly ever your all-American friends of 20 to 40 years of age. Virtually all heterosexual Americans and Europeans who had AIDS are intravenous drug users and folk. That's a fact that I have verified myself. Think about that. And the homosexuals who get AIDS had hundreds, if not thousands, of sexual contacts. That is not achieved with your conventional testosterone. It is achieved with chemicals. Those are the risk groups. They inhale poppers. They use amphetamines. They take quaaludes. They take amyl nitrate. They take cocaine as aphrodisiacs. Spin. What is it about intravenous drug use as opposed to ordinary drug use, like snorting cocaine, that would mean these people would go on to develop AIDS? Duesberg, it's a matter of degree. With drugs, the dose is the poison. You take one aspirin, you lose your headache. You take 200, you drop dead. You smoke one pack of cigarettes, you're fine, but if you smoke two packs of cigarettes for 10 or 20 years per day, you may get emphysema. It's the same with drugs. If you snort a line of cocaine on a weekend, you probably won't notice the difference. But if you inject it intravenously two or three times a day, that's when the toxicity shows up. Back to his argument about HIV. Viruses can only work one way. They can only be toxic if they affect a cell. They cannot work at a distance. There is no exception. Viruses are what you call an intracellular parasite. They don't have an autonomous life. They are just a little piece of information that is stuck into a cell and acts like a parasite. But outside of the cell, it's like a disk outside of a computer. Spin. Is it possible that AIDS could be an autoimmune-created disease, but HIV isn't the trigger? Duesberg. Some of the AIDS diseases could possibly be autoimmune diseases. Certainly not all. 38% of American AIDS cases have nothing to do with immune deficiency. 38%. 10% are Kaposi sarcoma, 19% are the so-called wasting disease. And then Spin goes, that is seen in Africa a lot, the Slim disease. Duesberg, yes. There it's somewhat different. It usually is coupled with infections, but the American or European wasting disease is actually specifically defined as a non-parasitic disease. We're going to turn the tape over here, folks. Let Bill put his message on. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
We're not able to verify Alex's research here at the research center here at the Hour of the Time, but I urge you to listen again to his tapes and research it yourself, because he really has something to say. I can remember the years when I was visiting my friends in Haiti from 83 to 85, just before the political coup. And the beginning talk about AIDS was blaming people from Africa, America, Haiti, everywhere. You just couldn't really put your finger on it. And again, we wonder why it wasn't a public health measure to quarantine a few people in the beginning before it picked up.
Continuing with Dr. Duesberg. But the American or European wasting disease is actually specifically defined as a non-parasitic disease. Anyway, 6% is dementia, 3% is lymphoma cancer. If you add those up, that's 38% of all American AIDS cases. Out of 250,000, that's about 100,000. Their diseases cannot be explained by any form of immunodeficiency whatsoever. Why is it considered AIDS then, asks Spin. That's one of the questions I would love to know the answer to. I have asked several experts. They always get mad. AIDS is always presented as if it's the immune deficiency. It is not at all. Cancer has nothing to do with immune deficiency. Spin. So what is the common denominator between all of the 25 AIDS diseases? Duesberg. None. They name it AIDS, that's all. None of these 38% have anything whatsoever to do with immunodeficiency, but they're called AIDS. That's not one AIDS disease. There's not one AIDS disease that's new. What is new is only the incidence of these diseases in 20 to 45 year old men, mostly, and a few women, which has gone up. Spin. I've always thought the 25 diseases that formed the AIDS syndrome had the common denominator that they were the result of immune systems' inability to stave them off. Duesberg. Now listen to this carefully, folks. That's how they try to sell it without looking at the evidence. But cancer is not a consequence of immune deficiency, and we're talking about Kaposi sarcoma. Dementia has nothing to do with the immune system. Your brain is independent of the immune system. Of course, if there's no immune system and your brain gets infected, you can get meningitis, but it doesn't affect your IQ. Sure, in the end, if everything fails, you can get all sorts of diseases. Even if you accommodate the virus with all sorts of absurd and paradoxical hypotheses, indirect mechanisms, cofactors, autoimmunity, a 10-year latency period, even that doesn't get you around the solid number of 4,621 HIV-free AIDS cases worldwide, with a third of these in the United States. How do you explain those? You couldn't have a better alibi than for it not to be there. You couldn't have a better alibi, and that is suppressed. Here we have a real cover-up. Last year, the numbers of these cases was going up like crazy. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the National Institute of Health, and the CDC called a meeting. And you know what they did? They gave it a new name. They call it idiopathic CD4 lymphocytopenia, or ICL. When you're HIV-free now, folks, it's no longer called AIDS. They're going to diagnose you as having ICL. Spin. There are 4,000 cases that don't have HIV, but the 250,000-plus cases that remain do have HIV. Duesberg, that's what you think. How do you know that? Spin, because they've been tested. Duesberg, by whom? Spin, by their physicians. Duesberg, so who tells us that they have been tested? Spin. A guy goes to his doctor, clearly very ill. He has AIDS. He's tested or was tested earlier and is found to be HIV positive. Duesberg. Even now, there is no record anywhere that says in how many American AIDS cases HIV was actually found. And you know what, folks? Dr. Duesberg is right, because I have found out exactly the same thing. Spin. But in every AIDS case, the CDC would know whether or not the patients were HIV positive because their physicians reported it. Listen carefully what Dr. Duesberg responds with. I verified this personally. You're led to believe this by the CDC, but the evidence that HIV is there, they never disclose. Nowhere in the HIV/AIDS surveillance report, as they call the national statistics kept by the CDC, do you ever find HIV data. No survey on HIV at all. All they talk about is AIDS, and then you read a little more of the fine print as to how AIDS is defined. They accept what you call presumptive diagnosis. AIDS cases without HIV tests. You know what that means? That means This guy wears a leather jacket, has an earring, and is coughing, and he's from San Francisco. That's an AIDS case. I don't even have to check it, his physician thinks. I recently wrote a letter to Harold Jaffe, acting director of Division of HIV/AIDS at the CDC. He acknowledged 43,606 presumptive diagnoses up to 1988. Dr. Duesberg says he's checked literature, and he says he's came up with 62,000 and change cases until 1992. Spin. Let me get this straight. You're saying between 43,000 and 62,000 of the cases of AIDS up until 1992 were not tested, which means we have no idea whether or not they were HIV positive? Dr. Duesberg responds, absolutely. Spin. They may or may not have been HIV positive. Duesberg, yes. Even in the latest AIDS definition, in January 1993, they allowed presumptive diagnosis. In other words, a good number of them, even now, will be reported without an HIV test. And folks, don't let that throw you, because as I showed on the last show, HIV testing is nonsense. Continuing. Spin. The public perception is that all cases of AIDS have HIV, that a case is not defined as AIDS without the presence of HIV, which would mean, by definition, that somebody tested them. Duesberg. Most people assume, like you, that everyone with AIDS is positive, and that's not the end yet. We have what is called false positive antibody tests. They call them HIV tests. But you know what they're testing? The antibody can be there, and the virus could be long gone. I told you I wasn't making it up, folks. Spin. Additionally, there are cross-reactions, where the antibody might react, say, to malaria or arthritis, and that's mistaken for engaging HIV. Duesberg. Exactly. Or people vaccinated for the flu. Blood donors. 10 recently. 7 out of 10 were positive for HIV. Remember what I said, folks. Remember, there are many other diseases and reactions that will bring you a positive test for an HIV antibody, and most of the AIDS tests that are being used now, and even that shouldn't make you go out and want to get tested, because even if you find you have HIV, there are 5,000 people walking around in the world right now who have been diagnosed with AIDS and don't have a scratch of HIV in them. Now, okay. Spin. Did they have the virus? Duesberg. No. Spin. How do we know they didn't have the virus? Duesberg responds. They were checked a half a year later, and the test was negative. There was no virus. Every year, 12 million blood donations are checked. The donors are treated preferentially. They don't want them to get the flu, so they give them a flu vaccine free. 7 out of 10 of those guys then tested after the flu vaccine turned out to be quote-unquote positive for HIV. They didn't have HIV. The flu vaccine cross-reacted with the HIV antibody. How often is the test false, asks Spin. Duesberg responds, the test can be wrong over 50% of the time. If you just repeat it, half of them fall out immediately. But if you look at a group of newly recruited soldiers, 1 in 100 test positive, and when you check them again, 1 in 1,000 remains positive. Spin, that's pretty incredible. That means only 1 out of every 10 that tested positive is actually positive. Duesberg, you see, that's the point. The idea that everybody who has AIDS is known to have HIV is far from the truth. There is a significant percentage who are totally untested, and the tests are often unconfirmed, and even if they are confirmed, they are only antibody tests. There are a number of people who even have a positive Western blot, the most reliable antibody test. But when you look for the virus, it is still not there. Folks, I hope you're paying attention. I hope you are paying attention. I hope you will not get conned into even bothering to go out and get an AIDS test. Moving on with the interview with Dr. Duesberg. In San Francisco, there are 3 people, false positives, who found out now that they have no HIV, but were treated with AZT, which is designed to inhibit the virus. And AZT, as we all know, is extremely toxic. And they have AIDS now. They have pneumonia. They have pneumocystis, exactly like AIDS, and they have no virus. Spin. You presume it was because of AZT? Duesberg, that's what they're suing for. Spin. Explain why you have called AZT AIDS by prescription. Duesberg, it's AIDS by design. It was designed over 20 years ago as a chemotherapy. And chemotherapy is a rational but desperate treatment for cancer. The rationale is, let's kill all the growing cells for several weeks. The hope is, the cancer is going to be totally dead and you are only half dead and recover. Chemotherapy is a rough treatment. You lose your hair, you lose weight, you get pneumonia, you get immune deficiency. You literally get AIDS. You have nausea. You have all the AIDS symptoms because it's severe cellular intoxication. You kill a lot of good cells, too. Often the treatment works, the cancer is indeed dead, and you survive and recover. Now you give that drug to somebody indefinitely, not just for 2 or 3 weeks, every 6 hours. Your HIV-positive person takes 250 milligrams of AZT. So they lose weight, they become anemic, they lose their white cells, they have nausea, they lose their muscles. Like Rudolf Nureyev, they cannot even stand on their own legs, and they die, like Kimberly Bergalis, Nureyev, Arthur Ashe, Ryan White, and many others. That's what you call AIDS by prescription. There's one issue even more fundamental we scientists have never discussed. Is AIDS actually an infectious disease or not? You see, you can acquire a disease in two ways. Either by a microbe, and then it's an infectious disease, and then you can pass it on sexually or otherwise. Or you acquire it from the environment, that is, by toxins, like you acquire lung cancer from smoking or liver cirrhosis from drinking. These are two entirely different mechanisms of getting a disease, so how do we tell them apart? The infectious diseases have one thing in common. Without one single exception, all infectious diseases are equally distributed between both sexes. Zero exceptions. Spin. Isn't the argument, though, that the immune system is losing the battle? The antibodies may be there, but the T cells are being depleted, so the immune system is actually losing the battle. Duesberg. Only if the virus has ever overwhelmed the immune system. But it hasn't. The immune system does beautifully. It knocks the virus out to a level where nobody can find it. Dr. Gallo and Dr. Montagnier had a hell of a time finding it, because it was gone. That's why we look for the antibodies in the AIDS test. It can't find the virus. That's the third point. Again, no exceptions to that rule. Where you have an infectious disease, the microbe that is responsible for the disease is abundant and very active in many cells. Okay, spin. The argument about AIDS is that there are lots of people who do drugs and don't have AIDS. Duesberg, it's the dose. It's a genetic constituency. Some people are more resistant than others, but very roughly, it's a cumulative thing. It's a certain threshold you have to reach, and that varies personally. Now look at AIDS. It fits none of the criteria of any infectious disease. Not equally distributed, not soon manifested, no active microbe, nothing is there. You can't even find HIV if people are dying from AIDS. You can a tiny bit, but very, very occasionally. Spin, what about the 10% of AIDS patients that are women? Duesberg, those are drug abusers mostly. Spin, okay, the statistics say something like 75% of the women who have some kind of recreational drug history or were HIV positive and went on HCT. That still leaves about 25% that don't have a drug history. Well, continues Duesberg, see if you take 25% out of 10%, you're taking 2.5%. And now here we come to the definition of AIDS. AIDS is 25 old diseases under a new name in the presence of HIV. These diseases do occur with or without HIV. Spin. Is there a difference in the manifestation of, for instance, tuberculosis in a case where a woman has tuberculosis and HIV, and a case where a woman just has tuberculosis? Duesberg. None that I know of. Spin. Absolutely the same, and they should, if they're both of average health, either recover or die at the same pace? Duesberg, it should be exactly the same. The only thing is that because HIV is rare in this country, only 1 in 250 Americans, or 0.4%, are HIV positive. And because it's so difficult to pick up, the odds are that he or she may be one of those people who have practiced risk behavior or been receiving transfusions.
Now, let's read a little bit more here, and this I hope you'll pay very, very close attention to. Spin. What you're saying is, woman A and woman B are identically sick. So we can challenge the readership of the magazine that if anyone out there has AIDS and is HIV positive but hasn't done any risk behavior, they should contact us and let us look at their case history. And we would learn a lot if such a person who doesn't come from one of the risk groups has HIV and has developed AIDS. Have you scrutinized the case histories of any patient who has AIDS, is HIV positive, and doesn't come from a risk group? Duesberg. They are extremely rare. Those are the cases like Kimberly Bergalis. They give them AZT, and then it is finished. Spin. Did Kimberly Bergalis, the Florida woman who allegedly contracted HIV from her dentist, get AZT before or after she had AIDS? Duesberg. She had a yeast infection. That was her diagnostic disease, which is not so rare in women. And she had antibodies for the virus. Spin. After her HIV diagnosis, they gave her AZT. She was otherwise healthy, except for the yeast infection. Now, Alex's personal opinion is that your yeast infection, along with some other factors, will give you a false positive HIV test. But let's read on what Dr. Duesberg says. Tell me a woman with a yeast infection needs blood transfusions for anemia. Tell me a woman with a yeast infection who loses 30 pounds in a year. Tell me a woman with a yeast infection who loses her hair and needs a wheelchair because of muscle atrophy. How many women fit that description? I've heard of not one. Spin. And all she had at the time of prescription of AZT was a yeast infection? Are you sure of that? Duesberg. They said the yeast infection was first, and then she later also had some kind of pneumonia, and they don't say when they started her on AZT. But I have yet to ever hear of a 21-year-old that needs blood transfusions for pneumonia or a yeast infection. Spin. AZT destroys the bone marrow, doesn't it? Of course it does. It kills the red cells. Anemia is the first direct effect of AZT toxicity. If you have no red blood cells, you can't pick up oxygen. You're in trouble, my friend.
Folks, I'm going to stop here with the spin article from the September issue, and I'm going to continue now with a excerpt from the article on AZT in Spin Magazine for October 1993. It's out on the stands right now. Go and get it. You'll definitely like it. It discusses a recent study that has just been done that has proven, finally, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that AZT is a killer drug, and that the original study, which was done to determine its efficacy, was done by the same company that produces the drug, which is Burroughs Wellcome. Let me read you this. I think you'll find it rather entertaining. A recent Burroughs Wellcome-sponsored community forum held in New York City was intended to put the Concord results into context, a euphemism for damage control. But it erupted into chaos when the audience started raising questions. Burroughs Wellcome had pieced together a panel of doctors and activists to discuss, update, and reevaluate the data from the Berlin conference. Nothing is black and white anymore, said activist Mike Barr in his opening speech. Shades of gray are everywhere, but the audience was in no mood for shades of gray. At the question and answer session, one speaker said, "Hi, my name is Tom, and this is my question. Since the basis for this therapy is to destroy HIV, could you tell me what the specific keynote study is that proves HIV causes AIDS? I mean, only because it's pretty important since billions of dollars are being put into these drugs." At this point, part of the audience clapped, and the other half glared angrily or sighed disgustedly. Others spoke up, their voices weak at first, then stronger. "Answer the question, how do you know HIV causes AIDS?" The panel moderator hemmed and hawed. "I'll try to answer that," he said. "It's a very complex question." The audience was impatient. "Just tell us the study." Moderator, "It's a complex question, and there are lots of emotions on both sides. I try to read the literature on both sides, and this is my conclusion. There are many factors associated with the progressive decay of the immune system. It depends on what kind of vocabulary you want to use. When you say something is a primary factor, and when you say something's a cofactor." Audience, "Could we get the name of the study, please?"
Moderator. The study? Okay. I'm in clinical practice, so I'll have to enlist the help of the academicians up here to see if I can give you the name of the study. Audience. But everything is based on HIV. One man asked, how can you give a drug that causes AIDS? The physician's desk reference says that AZT will cause all the symptoms that are listed as AIDS symptoms. From the panel, Dr. Catherine Anastos, director of HIV Primary Care Service at Bronx Lebanon Hospital, snapped back. There are a few bottom lines that we have to acknowledge. One is AZT does not cause AIDS. AZT can have side effects in a certain number of people that cause symptoms that are similar to those caused by the disease itself. And when you're a physician or a patient, part of the challenge is to figure out whether it's the disease or the treatment that is causing the symptoms. And if it's the treatment, then it's not worth giving. But AZT is no different from any other drug that we prescribe for any other illness in that ratio. AZT is relatively non-toxic, especially in early disease, compared to most other drugs. Compared to what? Cyanide, we heard from the audience. Her voice was drowned in the din. Barr said he wondered why all these crazy people vilifying AZT were not smart enough, quote-unquote, to see that the other two antiretrovirals, DDL and DDC, were far more toxic than AZT. Another man got up. I've been HIV positive for almost 4 years. Now I find out from reading biotechnology that 3-13% of Amazonian tribes in the jungle tested positive and they have no AIDS. That the test reacts with all kinds of proteins that are not specific to HIV. This whole thing is a scam and I hope to see you all at the Nuremberg trials, lady. Other members of the audience screamed at him for being rude. At this point it seemed as if everybody was hollering at the top of his or her lungs. What's the name of the goddamn study that proves HIV causes AIDS? This is my life, and I've waited 10 years for the answer. Someone on the panel, nobody up here actually said HIV causes AIDS. I don't think the moderator declared a 15-minute intermission at this point. Upon resumption, the audience had to write its questions on cards. The moderator read the last one. I have been HIV positive and healthy, taking no treatment for 6 years. Every last one of my friends who has taken AZT or other antiretroviral therapy is dead. How do you explain that? The question was dismissed. My time, folks. Folks, if you get anything from what I've been telling you over the last couple of shows, understand it's that germs don't cause disease, and that AIDS is a scam, and that you don't need AIDS testing because AIDS is not what people are dying from these days. I have tons more information. If you want some of it, write to me. I want to get it out to as many people as possible. Alex Loglia, L-O-G-L-I-A, 217 East 85th Street, Suite 246, New York, New York, 10028. Good night, folks. Believe nothing, verify everything, and I hope you will do something with what you've learned.
I warn you in advance, folks, that tonight I am going to do a lot of reading. I'm going to quote a lot of different people. And I want you to understand from the start that I am not making up anything from what I'm going to be saying here tonight, but that everything I mention here is scientific fact, which I have discovered in my own research. I make this warning because you are not going to want to believe what you are about to hear. I'm going to talk to you tonight about vaccinations. Most of you out there have probably received some form of vaccination at one point or another in your life, or you may have children who are in the process of receiving vaccinations. Well, I have some very bad news for you folks. You once again have been conned. I am sure that you, like myself, have been raised to believe that doctors know what is best for you, that everything that comes out of the medical industry is done to help you, and that everything that doctors do is safe and well-tested and proven, vaccinations included. Unfortunately, we have all been lied to, and once again, me and all of you are responsible because we would rather put the responsibility of our health into someone else's hands instead of taking charge of our own lives and our own well-being. I'm going to say this bluntly so that it will make an impact on you and so you will hear me. You and your children are being poisoned, folks, and you are making pharmaceutical companies incredibly rich, and you are also unknowingly helping along the progress of what is going to become the greatest epidemic that the human race has ever seen, namely AIDS. Due to ignorance and foolish trust in the experts, you have been had. Now, the theory of vaccinations is based on four basic principles. Number one, vaccinations are relatively harmless. Number two, vaccinations are effective. Number three, vaccinations are responsible for the decline in infectious diseases. And number four, vaccinations are the only practical and dependable way to prevent both epidemics and potentially dangerous diseases. But, ladies and gentlemen, every single one of these assumptions is totally false. The theory of vaccination states that by giving a person a mild form of a disease via the use of an immunizing agent, specific antibodies are produced that will protect the organism when the real thing comes along. It sounds plausible enough, but it is totally wrong. No greater lie has ever been told to you. And believe it or not, vaccinations will not protect you from any disease. And you can still get, and many people are getting, measles, smallpox, polio, rubella, diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus, and other common diseases even after they have been vaccinated. This is a matter of public record, and I will give you some statistics later on that will truly shock you. Let me read you a little portion from Wayne James's book, Immunizations, The Reality Behind the Myth. But before that, write down this author and title. That's Wayne James, W-A-L-E-N-E, last name James, J-A-M-E-S. And the title is Immunizations, The Reality Behind the Myth. Most of what I'm reading from here tonight comes right out of that book, and it's very well footnoted and documented. So to save time, I'm not going to read you all the references. But you can get the book, and you can check it out, and you can check out the references. Here we go. Besides introducing foreign proteins and even live viruses into the bloodstream, each vaccine has its own preservative, neutralizer, and carrying agent, none of which are indigenous to the body. For instance, the triple antigen, DPT, which is the diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus vaccine, contains the following poisons: formaldehyde, mercury, and aluminum phosphate, and that's from the Physician's Desk Reference, 1980. The packet insert accompanying the vaccine lists the following poisons: aluminum potassium sulfate, a mercury derivative called thimerosal, and sodium phosphate. The packet insert for the polio vaccine lists monkey kidney cell culture, lactalbumin hydroxylate, antibiotics, and calf serum. The packet insert for the MMR vaccine produced by Merck Sharp and Dohme, which is for measles, mumps, and rubella, lists chick embryo and neomycin, which is a mixture of antibiotics. Now, chick embryo, monkey kidney cells, and calf serum are all foreign proteins, which are biological substances composed of animal cells, which, because they enter directly into the bloodstream, can become part of our genetic material. They can become part of our genetic material, folks. Remember that. It's going to be important later. These foreign proteins, as well as other carriers and reaction products of a vaccine, are potential allergens and can produce anaphylactic shock. Folks, anaphylactic shock is a nice word for brain damage. Reading on. Another problem with vaccines is that they go directly into the bloodstream without filtering by the liver. Dr. William Albrecht tells us the following, quote, "If you take water into your system as a drink, it goes into your bloodstream directly from the stomach. But if you take in fats, they move in through your lymphatic system. When you take other substances, like carbohydrates and proteins, they go into the intestines and from there are passed through the liver as the body's chemical filter, before they go out into the blood and circulate through the body. Most of your vaccination serums and proteins are not filtered by the liver. Consequently, vaccinations can be a terrific shock to the system. Injections of foreign substances, like viruses, toxins, and foreign proteins, into the bloodstream via vaccinations has been associated with diseases and disorders of the blood, brain, nervous system, and skin.
Rare diseases such as atypical measles and monkey fever, as well as such well-known disorders as premature aging, allergies, etc., have been associated with vaccines. Also linked to immunizations are such well-known diseases as cancer, leukemia, paralysis, multiple sclerosis, arthritis, and sudden infant death syndrome. Folks, I'm not making this up. This is mostly out of Physician's Desk Reference 1980 and Organic Consumer Reports of 1977. Now, let me tell you some of the effects of vaccinations that the medical profession admits to as expected side effects of various vaccines, again from William James's book. From the packet insert for the DPT vaccine, which is for diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus, under side effects and adverse reactions are listed the following. 1. Severe temperature elevations, 105 degrees or higher. Collapse with rapid recovery. Collapse followed by prolonged prostration and shock-like state. 4. Screaming episodes. 5. Isolated convulsions with or without fever. 6. Frank encephalopathy, which is brain damage, with changes in the level of consciousness, focal neurological signs, and convulsions with or without permanent neurological and or mental deficit. Nice big words, folks, but it's talking about brain damage, shock, and severe temperature. The occurrence of sudden infant death syndrome, which is SIDS, that's the acronym, has been reported following the DPT vaccine. Now, the whooping cough vaccine, which is a component in the DPT vaccine, has such a high percentage of neurological complications, including death, that several physicians have decided not to give it at all. And that is quoting Dr. Robert Mendelsohn. He goes on to say, Dr. Edward B. Shaw, a distinguished University of California physician, has stated in the Journal of American Medical Association in March 1975, I doubt that the decrease in pertussis is due to the vaccine, which itself is a very poor antigen and an extremely dangerous one, with many very serious complications. Reading on from Wayling James's book, a recent study at UCLA estimates that as many as 1 in every 13 children had persistent high-pitched crying after the DPT shot. This may be indicative of brain damage in the recipient child, says Dr. Bobby Young. And later on he says, quote, you know, we start off with healthy infants and we pop them not once, but 3 or 4 times the vaccine. The probability of causing damage is the same each time. My greatest fear is that very few of them escape some kind of neurological damage out of this. An even more recent figure on the reaction to the DPT vaccine indicates that 1 in every 100 children react with convulsions or collapse or high-pitched screaming. 1 out of every 3 of these, that is, 1 in every 300, will remain permanently damaged. Now, according to the testimony of the Assistant Secretary of Health, Edward Brandt Jr., before the U.S. Senate Committee on May 3, 1985, every year, 35,000 children suffer neurological damage because of the DPT vaccine. Bet your doctor didn't tell you that, folks. That just makes you wonder why he never told you this, doesn't it? It also makes you want to run out and get your kids vaccinated, doesn't it? Well, it gets worse. Here are some of the long-term effects of vaccines. This brings us to perhaps the most serious charge against vaccination, the subtle long-term effects. And again, I'm reading from William James's book. Evidence suggests that immunizations damage the immune system itself. By focusing exclusively on increased antibody production, which is only one aspect of the immune process, immunizations isolate this function and allow it to substitute for the entire immune response. Because vaccines trick the body so that it will no longer initiate a generalized response, they accomplish what the entire immune system seems to have been evolved to prevent. That is, they place the virus directly into the blood and give it access to the major immune organs and tissues without any obvious way of getting rid of it.
The long-term persistence of viruses and other foreign proteins within the cells of the immune system has been implicated in a number of chronic and degenerative diseases. In 1976, Dr. Robert Simpson of Rutgers University addressed science writers at a seminar of the American Cancer Society and pointed out the following. Immunization programs against flu, measles, mumps, polio, and so forth may actually be seeding humans with RNA to form latent proviruses in cells throughout the body. These latent proviruses could be molecules in search of diseases, including rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, lupus, Parkinson's disease, and perhaps cancer. Remember that, folks. Feeding humans with RNA to form latent proviruses in cells throughout the body. That's important. Moving on. Live viruses, the primary antigenic material of vaccines, and don't be scared by antigenic, folks, it just means any agent that will stimulate antibody production. The primary antigenic material of vaccines, which are live viruses, are capable of surviving or remaining latent within the host cell for years without provoking acute disease. They attach their own genetic material as an extra particle or episome to the chromosomes of the host cell and replicate along with it. This allows the host cell to continue its own normal functions for the most part, but imposes on it additional instructions for the synthesis of viral proteins. This presence of antigenic material within the host cell cannot fail to provoke autoimmune phenomenon, such as herpes, shingles, warts, tumors, both benign and malignant, and diseases of the central nervous system, such as various forms of paralysis and inflammation of the brain.
So what we're actually talking about here, folks, is viral genetic material being incorporated into your cells and laying the groundwork for autoimmune diseases. And we're going to get into this right now. Reading on. If the components of the immune system were designed to help the organism discriminate self from non-self, as a number of researchers believe, then latent viruses, autoimmune phenomenon, and cancer would seem to represent different aspects of chronic immune failure, wherein the immune system cannot recognize its own cells as unambiguously its own or eliminate parasites as unequivocally foreign. By the same token, we might say that the inability of the immune system to distinguish between harmful and harmless substances in the environment, as in the case of allergies, constitutes another aspect of chronic immune failure. Folks, what they're saying here is that vaccines encourage chronic immune failure by virtue of the genetic material that you get shot up into your bloodstream whenever you get vaccinated. The well-known author, lecturer, and health activist Betty Lee Morales writes that her parents, who were naturopathic doctors, predicted 50 years ago that cancer would be epidemic in her lifetime as a delayed result of mass vaccinations. Dr. Robert Mendelsohn, who is an authority on vaccinations and truly one of the most heroic medical doctors in this century, because he is telling the truth, extends this idea when he says, quote, "I think that most of the degenerative diseases are going to be shown to be due to X-rays, drugs, and polluted food, additives, preservatives, and immunizations." With all of our discoveries about the effects on the human body of ingesting substances not found in nature, one thing we ought to know by now is that many of these toxins, and vaccinations are toxins by definition, kill slowly or kill only after the lapse of significant periods of time. And that's a quote from Nicholas von Hoffman in his Washington Post column. Now, from around the world. From West Germany, we read of more vaccination casualties. A reader writing to Organic Consumer Report, June 13, 1968, mentions an article which appeared in Medical World, which stated that about 3,000 children each year suffer varying degrees of brain damage as a result of the smallpox vaccination. The same writer mentions another medical journal in which Dr. G. Kittel reported that in the previous year, smallpox vaccination damaged the hearing of 3,296 children in West Germany, and 71 became totally deaf. Hearing loss was reported by Dr. William Albrecht, who said in the article I quoted earlier, that a typhoid shot he received made him stone deaf in one ear as well as deathly ill at the time of the shot. Now listen to this, folks, because this is where the big con starts. In case after case of deaths, which are really deaths from vaccinations, the cause of death is never listed as the vaccine. Asthma, however, acute lymphatic leukemia, streptococcal cellulitis, tubercular meningitis, and infantile paralysis are just a few of the fake causes of death listed on the death certificate of people who are dying from vaccinations. So much for these poisons being safe. Now, let's see how effective they are. Statistics from around the world show unequivocally that infectious diseases like smallpox, diphtheria, whooping cough, scarlet fever, etc., began to disappear long before vaccinations ever came on the scene. Now, I'm quoting World Health Statistics Annual, 1973-76, Volume 2. Quote, there has been a steady decline of infectious diseases in most developing countries, regardless of the percentage of immunizations administered in these countries. I'll bet you didn't know that, folks. And I'll bet you don't know this either. But I do know this from my research and from my own experimentation. Personal hygiene and diet stop disease, folks. Not injecting virulent, free-floating genetic material into your veins with all kinds of poisonous, cancerous carrying agents, which is what vaccines are. I'm going to now give you a key as to why you've been conned into believing that vaccines do stop diseases. I'm looking at a chart from Australian Nurses Journal from June of 1981. A top chart shows a curve of deaths per million children under 15 attributable to scarlet fever, diphtheria, whooping cough, and measles. We're looking at a graph here. The graph runs the years from 1860 to 1965, and the death rate just goes down, having peaked in 1860 at 6,000 fatalities per million and bottoming out near zero by 1965. So it's just a downward sloping line going down from 6,000 to zero from 1860 to 1965. It looks really impressive, like that all of these communicable diseases have been wiped out. However, the only problem is that immunizations were introduced into this picture in the early 1940s, when the number of fatalities per million had already dropped from 6,000 to 1,000. Thus, looking at the nearly straight line of the curve, you see that the vaccinations did absolutely nothing because there is no alteration in the rate of disappearance of these diseases from the vaccination at the time when the vaccinations were first started to be administered. A similar chart below it refers to tuberculosis and typhoid from 1900 to 1960. And again, the lines are straight slopes downward, and you can see that the epidemics simply ran their course naturally and are totally unaffected by the vaccination programs, but the medical industry wants you to believe that vaccines are what wipe out diseases, and that is a totally bold-faced lie. If you've never read the book How to Lie with Statistics by Daryl Huff, I strongly suggest you do because you will get a much better idea of how you've been tricked. Now, I want to tell you about a much bigger lie that you've been fed. I want to talk to you about polio because polio is a disease that most people think was the great success story of vaccinations. Let me read again from Waylon James's book. Jonas Salk, the discoverer of the Salk polio vaccine, has been called the 20th century miracle maker and the savior of countless lives. We read glowing reports of the dramatic decrease in polio in the U.S. as a result of the Salk vaccine. For instance, the Virginia State Department of Health distributes a folder which tells us that polio vaccines reduced the incidence of polio in the U.S. from 18,000 cases in 1954 to fewer than 20 in 1973 to 78.
A recent article in Modern Maturity states that in 1953, there were 15,000 some odd cases of polio in the U.S., and by 1957, due to the Salk vaccine, the number had dropped to 2,499. However, during the 1962 congressional hearings on H.R. 10541, Dr. Bernard Greenberg, head of the Department of Biostatistics of the University of North Carolina School of Public Health, testified that not only, now listen to this, folks, not only did polio increase substantially after the introduction of mass and frequently compulsory immunization programs, but statistics were manipulated and statements made by the Public Health Service to give the opposite impression. You have been lied to, folks. The polio vaccine caused more polio than it protected people from. Moving on, for instance, in 1957, a spokesman for the North Carolina Health Department made glowing claims for the efficacy of the Salk vaccine, showing how polio steadily decreased from 1953 to 1957. His figures were challenged by Dr. Fred Klenner, who pointed out that it wasn't until 1955 that a single person in the state even received a polio vaccine injection. Even then, the injections were administered on a very limited basis because of the number of polio cases resulting from the vaccine. It wasn't until 1956 that polio vaccinations assumed inspiring proportions. The 61% drop in polio cases in 1954 was credited to the Salk vaccine when it wasn't even in the state yet. And nevertheless, by 1957, when the massive vaccination program had taken place, polio was again on the increase. Digest that for a minute, folks. Let Bill flip the tape over, and we'll be back in a minute.
Alex is doing a wonderful job, don't you think, folks? Not only is it well-researched, but his delivery for someone who's never done a radio show before is excellent, much better than my first show, I can guarantee you. It's time to take a short break, folks. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short pause.
Okay, back to the Salk vaccine. Other ways polio statistics were manipulated to give the impression of the effectiveness of the Salk vaccine were as follows. One, redefinition of an epidemic. More cases were required to refer to polio as epidemic after the introduction of the Salk vaccine. In other words, you needed 20 cases per 100,000 to have an epidemic before the vaccine was introduced, and after the vaccine, they changed that number to 35 cases per 100,000 per year to require the definition of epidemic. Two, redefinition of the disease. In order to qualify for classification as paralytic poliomyelitis, the patient had to exhibit paralytic symptoms for at least 60 days after the onset of the disease. Now, that's after they started the vaccination programs, folks. Before the vaccination program started in 1954, the patient had to exhibit paralytic symptoms for only 24 hours. What this means, folks, is that if you walked into a doctor's office before the vaccine was introduced, and you said, oh, I've had paralytic symptoms here, and I've had them for about 2 weeks, they'd say, oh, that's polio. You had it for more than a day. But after the vaccine, if after the vaccine you walked into that same doctor's office and you said, oh, I've had these symptoms for 2 or 3 weeks now, they'd say, oh, wait 2 months. Then we can call it polio. That's how the statistics get manipulated, folks. Moving on. Dr. Greenberg said that, quote, this change in definition meant that in 1955 we started reporting a new disease, namely paralytic poliomyelitis with a longer-lasting paralysis. The third way statistics were manipulated was mislabeling. After the introduction of the Salk vaccine, Coxsackie virus and aseptic meningitis have been distinguished from paralytic poliomyelitis, explained Dr. Greenberg, and prior to 1954, large numbers of these cases were undoubtedly mislabeled as paralytic polio. Now, another way of reducing the incidence of disease by way of semantics or statistical artifacts, as Dr. Greenberg calls it,
is to simply reclassify the disease. And I have my own version of this here, folks, from the Los Angeles County Health Index Morbidity and Mortality Reportable Disease Data. I'm looking at a chart of cases of viral or aseptic meningitis and polio from 1955 to 1956. And lo and behold, what do I find? From 1955 to 1966, cases of polio dropped from 273 cases to 5. Ah, but number of cases of aseptic meningitis from 1955 to 1956 increases in almost exactly the same proportion from 50 cases to 256 cases. They simply changed the name, same disease, and you thought polio was wiped out at that point. Now, folks, the reality is this. Diseases, like everything else in nature, follow natural cycles. They come in, they reach their peak, and they leave, and no vaccination program on Earth has ever been able to change that. Polio disappeared in Europe between 1940 and 1950 without any vaccination programs whatsoever. In 1958, Israel had a massive type 1 polio epidemic after mass immunizations. And from the same hearings on H.R. 10541 that I talked about earlier, we find out that Massachusetts had a type 2 polio outbreak, and there were more paralytic cases in people who were triple vaccinated than in the people who were unvaccinated. Surprise, surprise, you thought the vaccine protected you, didn't you? Well, most of those cases of polio came from the vaccination. And that's fact, folks. Even Jonas Salk has admitted it now, that more than two-thirds of the polio in this country came from his vaccine. From Kudler and Fisher's book, DPT, A Shot in the Dark, we learn, quote, "There is a natural tendency for doctors to underreport whooping cough when it occurs in a vaccinated population and to overreport it when it appears in an unvaccinated population." Which means that if you go into a doctor's office and you are allegedly vaccinated and you have whooping cough, they won't call it whooping cough. They'll call it something else. And that's how we keep all our statistics nice and neat and safe and clean. Same thing's been done with measles, for example, folks. Reading from William James's book. From 1958 to 1966, the number of measles cases reported each year dropped from 800,000 to 200,000. The drug industry claimed this drop was due to vaccinations. However, there are some very interesting discrepancies. Number one, the incidence of measles had already been declining steadily for the past 100 years and was totally unaffected by the immunization programs for measles. Two, it wasn't until 1967 that the live virus vaccine, which is presently used, was introduced because the killed virus vaccine, which came out in 1963, was found to be ineffective and harmful. And yet, the vaccine, which was good and which they alleged did the job, did not even come out during the time that they are trying to take credit for wiping out the diseases in. Three, a survey of pediatricians in New York City revealed that only 3.2% of them were actually reporting measles cases to the health department. And four, in 1974, the Center for Disease Control determined that there were 36 cases of measles in all of Georgia. But the Georgia State Surveillance System reported 660 cases that same year. Folks, you can't believe anything you read, because every single statistic out there has been manipulated and twisted, and that's a fact that I can tell you unequivocally from my own research. Let me read about a little bit of rubella here. A large proportion of children are found to be seronegative, which means they show no evidence of immunity in blood tests, 4 to 5 years after receiving the rubella vaccination. In another study, 80% of Army recruits who had been immunized against rubella came down with the disease. Once again, folks, evidence that these vaccinations will not even protect you against the disease they are supposed to protect you from. And it goes on to say here that the same results were shown in a consecutive study that took place at an institution for the mentally retarded. Now, could the real reason vaccination promise and performance seem so contradictory be that the vaccination premise itself is faulty? As stated earlier,
The theory of vaccination postulates that the use of immunizing agents produces a mild form of a disease for which specific antibodies are formed that will protect the body when the real thing comes along. But as I mentioned earlier, it doesn't work that way, and Dr. Alec Burton, who's another brave doctor out there, points out the following, that there are children with what is called agamma globulin anemia, which means that they cannot produce antibodies, and yet these same children develop and recover from measles and other contagious diseases as spontaneously as other children. Now, what this means is that there are children out there who can't produce antibodies. Nevertheless, antibodies are the things that vaccines are supposed to stimulate in you against the particular diseases they're designed for. And yet, as shown here by Dr. Alec Burton, even without those antibodies, you will get cured or you will naturally become healthy again after having this disease without any vaccination. So, folks, so much for the idea that vaccinations are the only way to protect you. And the basic premise that they are built on, namely stimulating antibodies, is totally wrong. Okay. Another quote from William James's book. The mystery begins to unravel when we look at the work of Drs. Detman and Calacarinos. In one of their articles, they quote Dr. Wendell Belfield of San Jose, California, who says the following. Antibodies are not needed when the primary immunological defense, which is leukocytes and interferon, etc., is functioning at maximum capacity. Antibody production appears to occur only when the ascorbate level, and ascorbate is just a big word for vitamin C, in the primary defense components are at low levels, thereby permitting some viruses to survive the primary defense. What this basically means, folks, is that the premise that vaccinations are built upon are totally false. Vaccinations are allegedly designed to stimulate antibody production for the specific diseases they're designed for, and yet, as Dr. Burton showed earlier, antibodies are not even necessary for your body to properly and effectively combat diseases. In short, folks, this means that vaccines do not protect you against the diseases they are supposed to protect you from. Diseases in this day and age have become self-fulfilling prophecy because doctors tend not to diagnose specific diseases if the subject has already been vaccinated against those specific diseases. Vaccinations unquestionably do not guarantee you any protection. Their side effects are disastrous and often worse than the disease itself. And worse still, the premise that vaccines are built upon are pure, unadulterated nonsense. You've been taught that antibodies are little shock troops of your immune system, and they go out and kill all the nasty germs that are attacking you day in and day out. And the reality, however, is that antibody production is not your primary immunological defense, and the idea of stimulating them by injecting you with poison serums and free-floating genetic material and all kinds of poisonous carrying agents and stabilizers and vaccines is completely absurd. Okay, let me read you a little bit about immunity here, because it's going to become important over the next few minutes of what I'm talking about. When immunity to a disease is acquired naturally, and again from William James's book, the possibility of reinfection is only 3.2%, according to journalist Marion Thompson. If the immunity comes from a vaccination, however, the chance of reinfection is 80%. Did you hear that, folks? 80% chance of reinfection from unnaturally acquired immunity from vaccinations. Dr. William Howard Hay has pointed out that in any epidemic of communicable disease, only a small percentage of the population contracts the disease. Most people are naturally immune, so if a man who has been vaccinated does not contract the disease, that really proves absolutely nothing. If he had not been vaccinated, the chances are he would not have contracted the disease anyway. We have no way of knowing. Further, quote, just because you give somebody a vaccine and maybe get an antibody reaction doesn't mean a thing. The only true antibodies, of course, are those you get naturally. And that's from Dr. Detman in an interview with Jay Patrick. Natural diseases are a lot safer than acute artificial complications from vaccinations. And that's a quote from Dr. Robert Mendelsohn, who I mentioned earlier.
However, perhaps the strongest statement against the effectiveness of artificial immunization comes from Dr. William Howard Hay. Quote, it is nonsense to think that you can inject pus, which is most of the serums that we're talking about, into a little child and in any way improve its health. There is no such thing as immunization, but we sell it under that name. If we could by any means build up a natural resistance to disease through these artificial means, I would applaud it to the echo. But we cannot do it. The body has its own methods of defense. These defense methods depend on the vitality of the body at the time. If it is vital enough, the body will resist all infections. If it isn't vital enough, it won't, and you can't change the vitality of the body for the better by introducing poisons of any kind into it, and those poisons of any kind he's referring to are vaccines. Now, I'm sure there are many of you out there who know more about science than I do, but I am a concerned citizen, folks, and I have truly done my homework. And let me tell you, vaccinations are poisons. They do not protect you. They are weakening our immune systems, and my research indicates that allergies are the direct result of large-scale immunization programs foisted upon us in the last 50 years. And isn't it weird how right now there is such a big push on to force every child and every person in the U.S. to be vaccinated for all kinds of diseases? Thanks, Bill Clinton. Now, be logical, folks. The only person you put at risk, even by the medical industry's own stupid logic, is yourself if you refuse to be vaccinated. Think about it. If everyone else is vaccinated, then they shouldn't get the disease, right? Then the only person you're putting at risk by not being vaccinated is you. Makes sense. Then how does the government dare to justify forced vaccination? Folks, it will only happen if you let them, and it is happening right now. I can assure you that even without any intentionally created diseases, many Americans will be dying over the next 10 to 15 years, and AIDS will be blamed. Be careful. Wouldn't it be ironic if AIDS as we know it did not exist at all? From my own research, I can tell you with complete confidence that the vaccines being foisted upon us can weaken our immune systems to the degree that AIDS-like symptoms and reactions will be all too common with or without AIDS. Do you remember what I read earlier about the genetic material being introduced into our bloodstreams from vaccinations and producing autoimmune diseases? Folks, we don't even need a government-created disease to have massive epidemic rates of immune failure, because that's what these vaccines are promoting. You see, folks, the medical industry can function much better if there are millions of mysteriously sick people out there. Wait and see. But add to this the fact that our government has been working on creating cancer and AIDS viruses for years. And linked to this, the possibility of large-scale implantation programs done via vaccination programs. It fits so perfectly well together. They can implant you, weaken your immune system, and take your money all at the same time. Now, you've been conned another way, and this is by the word virus, because you think you know what a virus is, and you do not. Rest assured that viruses are not what you think they are, and I'm going to quote you a little bit more from Waiting James to give you a hint. All living organisms, including bacteria and viruses, contain genetic material, which is DNA and RNA. In fact, live viruses themselves are genetic messages. Live bacteria and viruses can transfer their genetic information to animal cells, including human cells, which are taken up by other cells in the body. Although the body generally will not make antibodies against its own tissue, it appears that slight modifications of antigenic character of tissues may cause it to appear foreign to the immune system and thus a fair target for antibody production. Remember what I said earlier about how vaccines give us genetic material that get incorporated into our cells. Thus, vaccines lay the foundation for autoimmune diseases and other disorders of the immune system, such as rheumatoid arthritis, rheumatic fever, lupus, scleroderma, and a lot of other nasty diseases. It is reasonable to assume that our contemporary, quote, epidemic of allergies has at least some of its roots in the practice of vaccination. And again, that's from Waving James. Now, beware, folks, I have saved the best for last. The Clinton administration has buckled the pressure to implement a stepped-up mass vaccination program, and you and your children, if not already, will now be forced to endure all the truly evil effects of these terrible vaccines. Every day I see stories of the various state laws forcing Americans to inject these poisons into their veins, and don't buckle to the pressure because you do not have to, because no one, absolutely no one, can force you to inject anything into your blood, and no one can force you or your children to be vaccinated. I've avoided vaccinations, and you can too. They will threaten you with not letting your kids go to school or not get a job or anything else they can think of, but it is all, excuse us, folks, it's all bullshit. However, if enough people do not speak up now, we may all indeed be forced to take in these horrible poisons. Often, all it takes to avoid vaccination is a simple form you can type up for yourself, referring to Senate Bill 942, number 3380, under title Exemption from Immunizations, and let me read that bill right now, because it's really interesting. 3380, immunization of a person shall not be required for admission to a school or other institution if the guardian, parent, or adult who has assumed responsibility for his or her custody and care in the case of a minor or the person seeking admission themselves files with the governing authority a letter or affidavit stating that such vaccination is contrary to his or her belief. The other thing you can do is go to your doctor and ask for a vaccination guarantee. Basically, what you say in this little form is that you're guaranteeing me that this vaccination will protect me and not cause any nasty side effects, or you will give me $1 million. And if the doctor refuses to sign that, you can refuse to get the vaccination. Now, even better, there's a book written by a lawyer who's done a lot in this area and has a lot of firsthand experience in circumventing vaccination laws. It's called Dangers of Compulsory Immunizations, How to Avoid Them Legally, by Tom Finn. Your best bet is also to get a copy of a little booklet called Vaccinations Do Not Protect by Eleanor McBean. Get a pen, folks. You won't find these books in Barnes & Noble. You can call 203-929-1557. That's 203-929-1557 and ask for Joe Willard, because the only place I know you can get any of the books I talked about today is from an organization called Natural Hygiene in Connecticut. That's 203-929-1557 and ask for Joe Willard. She's a wonderful woman who's done more to help free Americans from medical slavery than anyone I know in this country. The books I mentioned are not free, of course. You still have to pay. It's America. But ask Joe for the McBean book and the Tom Finn book, or even just get the McBean book, because in the McBean book are the forms that I mentioned earlier to exempt you. It'll be $4 or maybe $10 if you get both of them. You can even learn how to travel abroad without getting vaccinated, folks. Get educated and let your representatives in Congress know, and let your family doctors know that you know what's going on, because you have to protect yourself and your kids. And these people, your congressmen and doctors, may not have any clue about any of this, and it's your responsibility to educate them. Because most doctors are woefully ignorant of these things and have also, like you and me, abdicated their responsibilities for most of their life. Now, hopefully, soon I'll do a follow-up to this tape where I'll tell you how this massive fraud about viruses, diseases, and vaccinations was perpetrated, and how you have been conned into believing that germs cause disease, which, shocking as that may sound, is totally false. Germs do not cause disease, and I will get to that sometime real soon so that you can hear about that here on the show. Now, I'll also tell you a little bit of medical history in that tape, a little history that you never knew about the great fraud perpetrated by Louis Pasteur, who was a plagiarist, who is the father of the modern germ theory, and also the father of vaccinations. And that, I'm sure, will also truly surprise you. Now, folks, refuse to be poisoned, refuse to be vaccinated, educate yourself about vaccines, and just for fun, ask Joe Willard at Natural Hygiene to recommend a book on how to be healthy the rest of your life. Because if anyone in this country knows the answer to that question, she does. She's a great person. She'll love to help you out. The number there again, 203-929-1557. That's Joe Willard at Natural Hygiene. She is indisputably the best source in America for information regarding immunizations and, indeed, how to become healthy. I don't own stock in the company or anything, by the way. I know I've bugged her quite a bit, But I'm only doing that because I know that she is the best source for this kind of information, so definitely give her a call. Ladies and gentlemen, it has been a pleasure, and if you only remember one thing from all you've heard tonight, please remember this. The future truly lies in your hands, so get out there, take what you've heard tonight, and do something with it. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Fakeologist's Master Fake Theater. For more information on this and other audios, please go to Fakeologist.com. If you like this production, please encourage Fakeologist and send a small monthly donation of just $1.19 a month to Fakeologist on PayPal. Thank you, and tune in again for another edition of Master Fake Theater.